transportation to order. It is January the 26th, 2005. And I'm going to change a little bit of the agenda right now to accommodate one of our senators who would like to testify. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 153 in order to hear Senator Deckard. And then I will be closing the public hearing, going to the informational meeting, and coming back to the other testimony. Welcome, Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do appreciate fitting me into what probably is a very busy agenda for you. I'm Ryan Deckard. I represent Beaverton, Southwest Portland, and Alloa. And I am going to confine my comments to about a minute so that you can get on with your agenda. But I have a real... I'm here to oppose Senate Bill 153, and I'll just say very frankly, you have my written comments in front of you. We have a photo red light and a photo radar program in the city of Beaverton, and I'm a little distressed that this legislation is before us because this legislature has passed the authority to the city of Beaverton to run a program, and it is a program that has been widely supported by its citizens. I was one that was at least partly skeptical of being a resident of the surrounding area of the photo radar and the photo red light, but I will tell you that it really is a local control issue on this one for me, because the residents of that city have spoken very clearly and in very emphatic terms that they value the photo red light program that they have. And so for me, this is one that I feel my opposition is really centered around. If there is not a problem, what is the... This is a solution in search of a problem, and the city of Beaverton has a good relationship with its citizens, and a program is working, and I would ask that the state not involve itself in the decision that we've made to grant them the local authority to run a photo red light and a photo radar program.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator Decker.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing. And the first item on our agenda this afternoon is an informational meeting. One of the things that we're trying to do on this committee is gain as much information as we can so that we can help Oregon have a competitive edge with economic development. And that includes several entities such as ports, airports, and rail. And in order to make informed decisions, we want to know as much about what is present in Oregon today and what can we do that can improve on that. And with me today is, with us today is John Gray, the executive director, and also I'll have you introduce yourselves.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and along with Cindy Robert, we represent the Union Pacific Railroad. We've asked John to come and give you this presentation. It's not just on behalf of the Union Pacific, but behalf of the Oregon Railroad Users League. You'll hear more of that. That includes Ken Armstrong, the Short Line Railroads that you'll be hearing from, Tom and Dave Barrows, who represent the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. And we work closely with Pat Egan at the Port of Portland. There's a number of others. I mentioned the old rule. It's a new organization of railroads, railroad users, and the ports, strongly supported by the Oregon Department of Transportation. There's a reception tomorrow night. I hope all of you have received that invitation and can make it at the train depot and here in Salem. Now, John Gray is from Omaha, Nebraska. He is a man that has a vast knowledge about the railroads. His background, and just since you have something in common, he went to school, Tulane University in New Orleans, where he got both his undergraduate,
that'd be a good man.
Undergraduate and master's degree, and he has a doctor's degree from Northwestern University in Chicago. I've gotten to know John, and I find you can bring up transportation. He can tell you the size of the port in Antwerp, Belgium. He can tell you all kinds of transportation information. So with that, I'd like John to talk to you about the railroads, how they run, and what they do here in Oregon.
Welcome, John, and I want to ask you now, did they teach you how to cook good Cajun food?
I try, but it just doesn't work as well.
All right. Well, welcome, and we're happy to have you here this afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, let me say that pleased to be here and to be able to talk to the committee about what the railroads do and how we do it and what some of the principal issues are in Oregon, Washington, the Pacific Northwest area in general, Oregon specifically. I'd like to also thank Burlington Northern Santa Fe, who, although they are our competitor, that we have come view on many issues concerning some of the public issues that we both have to deal with, and they've graciously permitted me to say a few words that also about things that will involve them as well as Union Pacific as we go forward here. There's a switch back here somewhere.
Yeah, they'll take care of the lights over there for you.
Let me speak just a little bit about Union Pacific and what we are, what we do, and what our competitor Burlington Northern Santa Fe does. We are one of the two Western Class I railroads. The two of us basically blanket the West. If you look at the map that we gave you of our railroad and you looked at one of Burlington Northern Santa Fe's, you would see that for the most part they pretty much overlap us everywhere that we go. With a few exceptions, we're a bit stronger in Texas than they are. They're certainly stronger in the northern tier of states such as the Dakotas, Montana, and Washington State than we are. The types of markets that we serve, the industries that we serve, and the areas that we serve are largely the same, and it is basically from the West to the gateways to the Southeast, the Midwest, and the Northeast. We're about the same size companies. Last chance I had to look at it, and the data I believe is published weekly, but the last time I looked at it, we're at about 50% market share, each of us in the West. That's been up and down, goes up and down by 5 to 7 percentage points over the years as one or the other of us does better work than the other. But it generally revolves around that same area. We are about about $12 billion a year corporation, and we operate on about 33,000 miles of track in 23 states. We have almost 50,000 employees, about 48,000 now. It's something that we move a lot of the business of the United States. You don't hear about either of us a lot, but to give you an example of where we fit in nationally in the economy, between the two railroads, the coal that we haul supplies about a third of the electricity that's consumed in the United States, and of the goods imported into the United States in containers through the West Coast, almost all of that that is going outside of the port areas themselves, the port cities themselves, goes by one of the two of us to markets. And if the likelihood is, if you drove an automobile anywhere in the West, that one of the two of us delivered it into the West. Is very, very high proportion of the automobiles that are driven out here that came here by rail, well over 90%. So, with that, to give as a little bit of background on where we are in the national context, let me show you a little bit. I think it's the second slide in your package on a little bit about what Union Pacific and is in the Northwest. The Northwest is a critical part of our network. It's an important part of where our revenue base comes from. It's important to us in a number of ways, and I will talk to those in a few minutes. If you look at the strength of the two carriers, Union Pacific is the stronger of the two in Oregon, has a little bit more dense network in Oregon, and a bit more relationship to the economic activity here. Burlington Northern Santa Fe is the stronger of the two in Washington. And having said that, it's a relative term for both of us, because both states are important to us, and in the way that our networks operate, for us, it's very difficult to separate the two. That things that we do in Oregon have an impact on our operations in Washington, a severe impact, and vice versa. Things that we do in Washington have a very important impact on how well our business moves in Oregon. So, to some extent, because we are network industries, it's hard to separate the two areas, and indeed Idaho is almost as closely linked to some of the things that happen in this region. But having said that, if you look at Oregon, you see that it is a substantial amount of our revenue base that comes from Oregon. About 7 to 8% of our revenue base originates in Oregon, so it's a place of critical importance to us. And if you look at the total for Oregon and Washington, it's over 10% of our revenue base is in this area. You cannot really separate a railroad from its customers in understanding how we work, why we do what we do, and what's important to us. And because of that, I'd like to very briefly walk you through what the important customer areas are for us in Washington and Oregon, and give you a sense of how this plays into what we do as a railroad. For one thing, on our system, Oregon is the second most important carload origin area on our railroad. Oregon and Washington combined, very important to us. But even Oregon alone is critical in terms of the production of products for our railroad. The carload area that's what we describe as if you see a freight train going by and it has all the different types of cars on it, box cars, tank cars, various types of flat cars, things like that. That's our loose carload area where we put the cars at the customer's door, they load them, we go and pick them up, haul them away, deliver them to another customer, and they unload those cars, and then we take them back for another cycle. Now, one of the most important things moved out of Oregon, by far the largest item in the carload business portfolio, is lumber and panel products, basic construction material produced in Oregon. I've noticed in a number of reports and a number of talks I've heard from people about the fact that there's a perception that this product is largely for the California Arizona market. So I took a look at the data that we have, because I knew we had an awful lot of this stuff going east of here in trains. What I discovered is that at least for what we handle, and I think it's similar for what BNSF handles out of the Pacific Northwest, that about half of it is going somewhere east of the Rocky Mountains. There's a remarkably large amount of this that is distributed on a nationwide basis, and in fact, you discover significant quantities of Oregon products going into New York, New England, to various places on the East Coast, and a lot going into the Midwest and into Texas. So it is a national market that we're dealing with on these products. For something like the paper products, it is more local. That tends to be more of a West Coast or Western product, the way that it moves. But for the food and agricultural products, almost 100% of what we move out of Oregon is going to the Midwest or to the East. There's very little of it that's going to other destinations. It's something that is very heavily oriented towards our longest haul gateways and is distributed again on a national basis. Now, the carload business is very important in terms of the economy to Oregon because it in large part represents what people produce here and the jobs that people in the local economy have to produce this material for export from either the Northwest region or from the state. However, there's another big item that is important for the rail network here, and that's what we move into the region, mostly for export from the Lower Columbia River ports. The most important one, certainly for us, which is the Port of Portland. The things that move in bulk into these ports for export are things like grain, soda ash, and potash. Don't sound very romantic, but they move a lot of it. And it's awfully important to a lot of other people inland from this area. And it's important in the job creation that it does through the port itself, not just for the port working of the port, but for the ship servicing, the brokerage that's done there. And in fact, if you look at the bulk movements through the Lower Columbia River area, that is the largest export area on the west coast of the United States for bulk materials. It is the primary export region for these items going into the Pacific Rim. And as I say, it is the four Lower Columbia River ports that are involved in this. Specifically on the grain, It comes into this area from everywhere in the West. Burlington Northern Santa Fe brings it in from Montana and the Dakotas. We bring in a little from the Dakotas that actually comes through Canada and then comes back into the States, up in Idaho and then to the Port of Portland. It comes from eastern Oregon, eastern Washington, Idaho. It comes from the Midwest, from Nebraska, Kansas. The grain moves from all over the Midwest and the Western U.S. into these ports for export. The soda ash, on the other hand, is a very focused commodity. Now, soda ash is, as I say, it doesn't sound terribly exciting, but it's an ingredient essential to glassmaking, and it's used all over the world for this purpose. And the largest source of soda ash, about 90% of it, is from a little area in southwestern Wyoming. And millions of tons of it are mined every year.
Excuse me, John, what did you say it's used for?
Glassmaking. It's used in from all, it, the glass process takes about 30% of what goes into that is soda ash. A lot of it is sand, but soda ash does gives it a lot of the structural characteristics that glass needs. That's the largest use. There are other chemical uses that you can make that you have for it, but the primary port of export for that to the whole world, both Europe and to Asia, is the Port of Portland. It is the largest export. The port has the largest export terminal of this material of any place in any place in the United States, and by that definition, the world for export of this material. So it's. Again, the movement of this is on a large scale. Millions of tons are moved into this area and then out of the port. Likewise, there's another material called potash that comes out of Saskatchewan that is moved through the Port of Portland for export. It comes in bulk both on Burlington Northern Santa Fe and ourselves. They receive it from the Canadian Railroads in Vancouver, BC. We receive it at Eastport, Idaho, from Canadian Pacific. And again, it moves down to the port for export, and has been a growing item. So these bulk exports are a very important part of the portfolio business that moves in and out of this area. Third general category are what are the international containers, and mostly coming in through the Puget Sound ports, to a limited extent through the Port of Portland, but the large movements in this area through the Puget Sound ports. To which you ask, well, why should we care? And the answer on that is that after it gets to Puget Sound, if it moves east over Union Pacific, and several trains a day do, it goes through Oregon. It goes through the Portland terminal. It transits Oregon along the southern bank of the Columbia River and across the Blue Mountains towards the eastern destinations. So again, it's an item that we don't move directly into Oregon in large quantities, but a lot of it moves through Oregon. The other item is the domestic consumer goods that come into this area from all over the country. And this can be anything from imported goods that come through the Port of Los Angeles that coming to this area, the ship line calls it Los Angeles, not Seattle, Tacoma, or Portland, that comes up to this area. It can be consumer goods coming from anywhere in the eastern or midwestern U.S. into this area. And it's a lot of it moves in trailers or containers on flat cars, the intermodal portion. Some of it moves in rail cars. But as far as the consumer goods, obviously there's far greater movement into the Northwest than there is out of the Northwest at this point. Now, there's all of these areas are supported operationally by the entire network that we operate. If you look at where our operational centers are for this area, for ourselves, they're in Portland, where we have probably the most substantial terminal facilities in the area for originating and terminating freight. They're in Eugene, where we again have a large origin termination of freight trains, both on our own railroad that are originated by our own railroad and by the short line, the local service connections that we have in Eugene. And then finally, the other critical terminal forces over in eastern Oregon at Hinkle, where we have it's at the intersection of our lines coming from Spokane down to down into Oregon, and the east-west main line from Portland and Seattle going towards the Midwest and the east. So that area is not a huge origin destination area for us, but it is where we sort a lot of the freight that comes in and out of this area, and where we have several hundred employees, 500 to 600 employees, I believe, working in that area. So it's
John, excuse me, does the switching yard in Eugene belong to Union Pacific?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Yes. Now Burlington Northern Santa Fe, on the other hand, has their equivalent of our Hinkle facilities are in Pasco, Washington, right across the river from us there. They have extensive facilities around Vancouver, Washington that support their Portland terminal, and then they have extensive facilities around Seattle and Tacoma that support the area. Again, the facilities are in Washington, but it supports a lot of activity that they do in Oregon as well. It just happens to be the way their network was built versus the way ours was built in terms of the flow of their business. Now, the other facility that we have, the other one that's critical to movement of goods efficiently in and out of Oregon, particularly those going to California and Arizona, is in Roseville, California. We have the intersection of a lot of large volume lines in that area, plus a lot of local business in that area, and call for the construction of a very large terminal in that area that sorts all the business coming south out of Oregon and Washington for the specific destinations all over Central and Southern California for us. And quite frankly, it's something that it would be difficult to do any further north. It's not something that we can do efficiently if we try to move that north. Now, I mentioned that the area around Eugene in particular is a major point in which we receive business from the local service, the short line carriers in Oregon. I want to emphasize the importance of these carriers because I think they're very important to understand their role in the state, and then I'll come back to them towards the end of my presentation to talk just a little bit about some of the issues that are important for these carriers. Obviously, they will be speaking for themselves, but I wanted to emphasize that even from the Class 1 perspective, that there are really critical issues involving these local service carriers for the state. If you look at the map that I gave you of Union Pacific in Oregon and Washington, you see that there aren't many branch lines left on there. You see a lot of little black lines that go off of the main line, the red lines that represent our main line in the two states. But you won't see many red branch lines going out into many areas because most of those branch lines have been sold to these smaller carriers or leased to these carriers. Why was it done? It was done because the alternative in many cases was long-term elimination of the service. And we viewed it as a strategy in which we could improve the service to local industry, as a strategy in which the cost for the service would remain under control more effectively, and as a strategy in which the local business would be more effectively served because it would be handled by people in the local area. For the most part, this strategy has been very successful for us and for a lot of our customers in the local areas. That we think that they have received better service than we could have provided them if we had kept these lines. We think that the business has grown substantially because these short line carriers have provided this type of service and been able to do it on more competitive rate basis. But we also recognize that as the short lines have gotten older and have matured, that the capital needs that they have changed. And in many cases, even lines that were in good shape when they were handed over to the short line are starting to show their age. In other cases, perhaps more importantly, the patterns of their customers that need to use them have changed. And so lines that didn't have a requirement for heavy-duty cars in the past, over the past few years have evolved into that requirement, and that the demands that have been placed on them have changed. And so we think that there are going to be capital needs in the future that they're going to have to meet that have a place in the public sector. And I'll talk to that a little bit later as I get into what we view as some of the important rail issues in Oregon. But keep the short lines in mind as we go forward, because I think they're an important part of the Oregon economy in providing transportation services for the Oregon economy, and I think that they are something that you need to consider as an important potential use for public money that might be available for rail issues. So, given what we see as the or what is out here and how the network works, what are some of the issues that are important that have a relationship to the public sector in one form or another? Well, We think that some of the most important, one of the most important issues is efficient operation of the Portland terminal. The Portland terminal has, over the years, gradually accumulated a lot more business than it used to have. At both business moving through the terminal and business moving to and from the port and local industries in the Portland area has grown, and it continues to grow. We would expect that it will continue to grow further. We think that it's important that we continue to improve our networks in ways which help support movement through the terminal. In some ways, we can do a lot of these things ourselves. In other circumstances, there are important projects which only the public sector can be involved in, simply because it happens that a lot of these projects involve publicly owned facilities today. And so we think that the movement through the Portland terminal and the congestion that is there just on the rail side is going to be a continuing issue. That we're trying to move a lot more trains through the terminal today than we were 20, 40, 50 years ago, and these trains are a lot bigger, have a lot more freight on them now than they did then, and the requirements for them, the requirements for infrastructure have changed, and we think there is a role for the public sector in helping to put in place some things to help us meet those congestion issues. Now, what are some of those things that that we think are involve the public? Well, it's kind of the next item I have on there. It's rail corridors, creation of rail corridors through urban areas. By this, I mean corridors in which the rail lines can be developed effectively, and we do not have highway crossings at grade. Where we have highway crossings across the rail lines. It doesn't mean eliminating existing crossings as much as it means building the overpasses and the underpasses at major streets to allow the traffic to flow more smoothly around the rail system. There are a lot of reasons for doing this. We think part of it is very much in the public interest. A big part of it is in the public interest, and one that it minimizes conflicts between the railroad and the local community in terms of both safety issues and in terms of the flow of traffic more effectively through these local communities. We think by doing this, though, permits the railroads to make the investments necessary in these corridors to more effectively use these areas to get rid of the congestion on our lines. From Union Pacific's perspective, we are not looking to the public to support things that we would do economically in any case. And we are not looking to the public to subsidize us on building projects for the railroad that are economically justified. But we would like to have the public's help in creating the ability to deal with the problems, and in urban areas a lot of that ability involves the separation of highway and rail traffic to as great an extent as possible. I think the other item that is important in these separations is that there's just flat out a safety issue that people get hurt, whether on the railroad or on the highways, when a train hits a car, or as we see in a fairly frequent number of cases, the car hits the train. It's amazing how many situations we have where a car just runs into the side of a train at these things. So there is a safety issue as well as a community impact issue that we think make the elimination of grade crossings to the extent possible a public issue, but at the same time they create the ability for us to invest our capital in the system more effectively and to make it operate more effectively for the rail system and the customers that the rail system supports. Another area that we think is an issue involving the public is passenger service. We recognize that there is an interest in the public in Oregon in operating passenger trains over our railroad. BNSF has recognized this same type of issue in Washington and done work there. We recognize that in our system that Oregon is the key area. Passenger trains take up a lot of capacity on the track. They take up far more capacity than a freight train does. Passenger train, if you divided the line into the number of, say, train slots that it could handle on a given day, the number of trains that could be put through the system, you look at a passenger train, it'll take up 2-3, depending upon the configuration of the system, as many as 5 times as many slots as a freight train. If it's running at the same speed as the freight trains, it takes up more slots than a freight train does because of safety issues and the need to provide a gap around the passenger trains to keep the safety of the system intact. If you're running passenger trains at different speeds, which generally you do, they run significantly faster than the freight trains, the situation is even more difficult, and you have potential conflicts between the two that generally get resolved in the passenger train's favor, but as a result, you end up with the freight train spending a lot of time waiting if this is done. So our expectation going forward as we work with the state on the passenger issues is that the investments will be made to recognize the capacity that a passenger train takes and that these investments be made by the public in the network to support the operation of these trains as they are desired by the public. Now, having said that, we found ODOT to be a very effective partner to work with on these issues, that they have recognized the important, if we're going to operate these trains, the importance of ensuring that we minimize the conflicts between passenger and freight trains. But there are other areas which we need to also recognize,
and I'm going to have to get you to wrap just due to time.
Thanks. Very 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 quick here, and that is in the passenger trains that the grade separation issues is just as important as they are in some of the urban areas, and again for safety issues, as was vividly demonstrated in California earlier today when 10 people were killed on a passenger train because of not having grade separations. They're important. The other area is the short lines and ensuring that the funding for them as their capital needs change, as they evolve, are recognized. These railroads serve the local communities that they're in, and most of them serve them very well. They do a lot of the hands-on work. They're important to the economy. They're important to the businesses that are involved with the short lines, and they're important to the economic development of a lot of the rural communities in Oregon. And we ask that as you're looking at issues and funding going forward, that you notice this importance and recognize it.
Well, we're going to have someone talk to us a little bit about the short lines. I want to ask you a question, and committee members, if anyone has just a pressing question, I'll take a few questions for John. But one of my questions is, if indeed you had more product to carry in Oregon, is the infrastructure there without a huge investment? And do you have the capability of moving far more product?
It depends upon where the product is and how it comes to us. That there as far as main line capacity in Oregon, right now we're in pretty good shape. As far as our terminals, they tend to be a little bit more pressed for capacity. We have managed to get enough people in place to handle more product over the last couple of years, and we have had some major locomotive purchasing programs that have helped us increase capacity. But in general, we tend to be in reasonably good shape in everything except the terminals. The terminals are starting to get a little bit crowded.
Okay. Do we have other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
John, on the comparative costs, could you give us just a short answer on, for instance, the comparative cost between truck shipping and rail shipping on a 25-ton load?
On a 25-ton load, they would probably have the advantage. Our cost advantage comes when we load a lot of product onto a rail car, and we tend to load 100 to 110 tons at a time. So we're getting 4 to 5 truckloads per rail car, and when that happens, typically the cost advantage just on the transport cost is probably close to 50%, and for some of our customers it's greater than that because it's easier for them to load and unload rail equipment than it is trucks at their plants.
Another question. Follow up
on a different question, actually, but I'm from Klamath County, and there are two questions shortly. I don't see the Lakeview Short Line on your map. And the second thing is that fairly recently there's been a great deal of increase in traffic on the Modoc line, the one that goes from Klamath Falls out through Alturas, as opposed to the one that goes along 97 down to Weed. I was wondering if you could just give me a short answer as to why those, how the Lakeview line hooks in, the short line there, and the other is why the difference and why the change in the freight tonnage.
Well, As far as traffic on the Modoc line, I suspect that it is BNSF traffic going down towards Beaver, California, because the Modoc line itself doesn't exist south of Alturas anymore. It's no longer there. The short lines in the south central Oregon area. We are actively looking at actually expanding the number that might be down there on some of our lines. We think that there are probably better ways to handle some of the local freight than we are handling it ourselves right now, and so we are looking at some potential expansion on that. We're a fair distance from getting all of the pieces in place to make a judgment on whether that's going to happen or not. But as I say, it is something we're actively working on at this point in time.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that we're under a time situation here, so I want to make this quick. But I know the Union Pacific has had some serious issues as it relates to congestion, and I'm primarily thinking internationally moving freight that comes in down in the California area. Can you just comment briefly on if those issues have been resolved as it relates to, I believe, employees, but it's one of the big issues in that situation.
The issues have not been fully resolved at this point in time. We have added 3,000 employees. We have added about 700 locomotives to create more capacity. Some of the issues cannot, because of the growth we've seen in traffic, some of the issues cannot be resolved except by building more infrastructure, particularly around Los Angeles. And that we are actively engaged in, but just like highway infrastructure, it takes time to build it. And
one additional follow-up, if you don't mind, Madam Chair. Could you give the committee maybe a ballpark in the amount of capital expenditure that UP makes on its rail system in Oregon?
This it It varies obviously a great deal from year to year. This year we will invest about $40 million in the rebuilding and upgrading of lines in Oregon. Some of it for track work, some of it for bridge work. $40 million. I'm sorry. It will be both on the lines, the north-south lines between Klamath Falls and Portland, and the east-west line over towards LeGrand and Huntington. One of the offshoots of that investment will be, we're hoping that even though it's our nickel on this part of the investment, that it will also provide some benefits for speeding up the passenger trains between Eugene and Portland.
Thank you.
All right. John, thank you so very much
thank you,
for
Matt.
Being here. It was a great presentation, very informative. And to speak for the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association, we have Larry Phipps with us this afternoon. And Mr. Ken Armstrong. You'll introduce yourselves for the benefit of our...
Be happy to. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Armstrong. I introduced myself because last time I was before you, last week I was representing the ports. I also represent the Oregon Short Line Railroads Association. I know that you are eager to get on with your business and also that there are gentlemen with guns behind me waiting patiently. So I'm going to try and move it along quickly and do nothing more than introduce Larry Phipps with Portland Western Railroad, who is currently the chair of the Short Line Railroad Association and is one of the lead voices for us. And with that, I'll introduce Mr. Phipps.
Madam Chair and committee members, I'm pleased to be here today, and I will take you through the history of the short lines briefly so that others here can get on with their matters. As was mentioned, the genesis of the short lines came about in the late 80s, early 90s. They basically were those branch lines which the class ones couldn't handle quite as efficiently as could we. They were, in many cases, they were branch lines that were abandonment candidates. Basically, we're the feeders, and we generate, we originate and terminate the freight within Oregon. Within the state, I'll take you through just briefly and tell you what some of the short lines are. You're familiar with them in your respective districts. On the western part of the state, we run from short lines that are 2 miles long to short lines that are 500 miles long. The Albany Eastern serves Lebanon, Sweet Home, Mill City, generates over 6,000 cars a year on a 50-mile railroad. The Central Oregon Pacific, you're familiar with, that runs basically from Black Butte, Weed, Yreka, comes into Oregon about Hornbrook, and then runs up alongside I-5 through Medford, Glendale, Riddle, Roseburg, Cottage Grove, and into Eugene, and then another line of the Corp that runs from Eugene out to Coos Bay and on to Coquille. That railroad serves timber products, Georgia Pacific, Roseburg Forest Products, Weyerhaeuser, major lumber companies, and on the Coos Bay side serves the Port of Coos Bay and the Roseburg at Coquille, as well as GP within Coos Bay. The Oregon Pacific Railroad runs out of Molalla, serves a lumber mill at Liberty and brings in poultry feed. It's only 14 miles long, but it does 1,000 carloads. The Peninsula Terminal is a 2-mile railroad that is immediately adjacent to the Port of Portland's Rivergate terminals. While it's a 2-mile railroad, as you note, it handles 2,700 carloads each year. The railroad that I'm with, the Portland and Western, we have 500 miles. We generate over 90,000 carloads, and we serve the eastern part, the western part of the Willamette Valley. We go to Toledo, to Willamina, to McMinnville. We go to Astoria. Our major customers are GPs, SP Newsprints, Cascade Steel. You see us here in Salem along the riverfront serving Boise and Cascade Warehouse. The Port of Tillamook Bay Railroad, 95 miles, and does 4,000 carloads of business from those lumber mills in the Tillamook area. The Willamette Valley Railroad runs from Woodburn to Staten, serves Trust, Joyce, and Norpak, and a number of other food processors. In eastern Oregon, the Idaho Northern does 4,600 cars. Lake County, that was referred to earlier, it shows here to be 15.24 miles, but that's the mileage within Oregon. It continues on to Alturas and connects at Alturas. It serves Fremont Lumber and a perlite shipper. The Klamath Northern serves the old Gilchrist lumber facility, and the Blue Mountain does 8,000 carloads and serves Smith Foods as well as other customers. The Wallawa Union is just recently formed, and it's owned by the county. It's the one up around St. Joe and Enterprise and is just getting started. The Mount Hood Railroad is a little bit different in that it handles very little freight, about 90 cars a year, but it does over $1.5 million in passenger revenues on its excursion trains. It brings in a lot of tourists and alike to the Hood River area, and has been quite successful with its dinner train. As testimony to the short line success, there's a chart in there that shows that in 1986, short lines made up 8% of the state's railroad mileage. That increased to 26% in 94, to 47% in 2001, and today the short lines make up 52%, over half of the state's railroad miles. Carloads, you see the same trend in carloads. We have gone from generating and terminating on the short lines 44,000 annual carloads to today, where we originate and terminate 178,000 carloads of freight. We do things besides freight. The Portland and Western operates a train from Portland to Astoria 4 months a year. And also, one of the benefits of short lines and preserving the railroad infrastructure and rights-of-way are the abilities and the capacity you have to handle commuter traffic. We're engaged in a project with Washington County to provide commuter service from Beaverton to Wilsonville. And just by looking at the map, you see all of the possibilities for railroad for commuter railroad off of the busy Class 1s, so that you could extend from Beaverton to easily to Salem Kaiser to McMinnville to Newburgh and places such as that. As John Gray mentioned in his when he was giving his testimony, one of the pressing needs is that these were, for the most part, light density branch lines when they became short lines. Some of them were candidates for abandonment. Much of it is light old rail. And today, with the 286,000 capacity rail cars, there's a pressing need for more infrastructure. We have plenty of capacity on almost all of our short lines. Most of the routes will run one or two trains a day, and we have the capacity to run three or four. So our capacity in that regard is virtually untapped. We have a few weight-restricted bridges that need to be brought up, but the most pressing need is in the rail and the ties. A question was asked about how much we invest each year. I can't speak for all of the other short lines, but we spend about $4 million a year on railroad infrastructure on the Portland and Western. In addition to that, in the last two sessions, there were bills that provided $2 million in grant funds to short lines. Each of those years, that $2 million leveraged up over $5 million worth of investments. I know, as a case in point, we received a grant for $294,000, and with that, we did a capital project on the Willamina line that was over $1.8 million. So there's significant leverage when we do take the public funds and invest them in infrastructure, and I believe you get more bang for your buck, more capacity for your buck when you put the infrastructure in railroads than you do with continuing with some of the highway investments. Today we move between the Portland and Western and the Central Oregon Pacific. We move about 700 carloads of logs each month, and each of those log cars are probably probably four or five log trucks that aren't now on Interstate 5. They come from Rainier and come down, as you'll see them each day along the riverfront here in Salem, going down to Douglas County, to Roseburg Forest Products, to Georgia Pacific, and to Weyerhaeuser. So, and that's a market that we think we have just begun to tap. So with that, if you have any questions, we'd be pleased to address them. And thank you for having us.
Very good. Thank you, Larry. Questions? No, no questions. Thank you so
thank
very
you.
Much
thank
today.
You.
You're going to all right. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 153. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Just briefly, Senate Bill 153 requires each city operating a photo radar light, either the cameras or a photo radar system, to present a biennial report to the Legislative Assembly by March 1st of each regular session year. It repeals sections of statutes which would terminate the authority for such systems on January 2nd, 2008. It directs the Department of Transportation to provide the Legislative Assembly with an executive summary of the process and outcome evaluations conducted by the cities. And once per biennium, the measure directs the cities to conduct an evaluation that looks at the effect of the system on traffic safety, the degree of public acceptance, and the administrative process for operating the system. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Metzger?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. A little background, members, on Senate Bill 153 and how this came about. This bill was pre-session filed by the Joint Transportation and Economic Development Committee, of which I chaired in the interim on December 2nd. It was a response to a long process of dealing with following the law on photo red light and photo radar. And this is going to be a very interesting hearing, and I'm so pleased to have the people who are in the audience testify today, because we're going to talk about the law and following the law, and I think you will find that they will be very supportive of following the law, and we'll have maybe an interesting discussion of how we actually enforce that. As chair, I received in my office early last spring some information from some constituents in the Beaverton area regarding the administration of the photo red light and photo radar law in Beaverton, specifically regarding the certificate of innocence, which is in statute, that requires that the case be dismissed if a driver provides their driver's license, and this is clearly not them, that the jurisdiction must dismiss. And found evidence that Beaverton was not doing that. In fact, unlike all the other jurisdictions, was in fact creating their own certificate of innocence that required that those drivers, even though it was clearly not them, not be dismissed from as the law required until they actually went out and found the other driver, their driver's license, things way beyond what the statute allowed. At that point, I did, and I sent a packet around for some of the documents for you to look at. I did send a request to Legislative Council to interpret the law. Is there something that we were missing here? And you see the copy of the response from Legislative Council that the law does not allow the jurisdiction to do that. I then forwarded a letter, which is also in your packet, to the City of Beaverton, asking them, along with the letter from Legislative Council, to simply follow the law like the other jurisdictions. And if for some reason they felt the law was inadequate, to approach the committee with legislation to modify it to where they thought it was more effective. They chose not to do that. Instead, they chose in a response to basically say, well, we're going to interpret the law the way we want to interpret the law, and continued that practice. When the Joint Transportation Committee was in Coos Bay, Madam Chairwoman, the administrator of the committee at that time, Janet Atkins, brought my attention to a couple of articles that are also in your packet from the Oregonian, which only appeared in the Western Washington County edition. So I never saw them. So they were about a month old at the time. They were written by Jerry Boone. They're also in your packet, showing that this practice was continuing throughout the city of Beaverton. And so it was a matter of frustration, as those of us who have been in the Assembly for a while, and if you notice, there's another article at the Oregonian about this one jurisdiction has a history of continuing to exceed the law. If there's so many cameras that are allowed, they would exceed it and have to eventually return those tickets. If you have to post a certain distance away, they would post it closer in violation of the law and eventually have to return those dollars to constituents. If it says the city can operate within the city, they would operate outside of the city. And in one case, I think there was a $40,000 return when it was found that they were operating, again, outside of the law. So this is a culmination of frustration with a jurisdiction has voluntarily decided to not obey the law, while the other ones who we're going to hear from today about how important the program is, how well it works, and I think we will all say amen to that, and we'll find it very interesting that they operate within the law and able to make this program work. So this is a response. It requires two things that are substantially new to the law. Number one, that in the report to the Legislative Assembly, it actually makes them articulate their process and the requirements that they have for administering their photo red light. So we can see if they're using something different than what everyone else is using, that we're going to be aware of that. The second thing it does, it puts a sunset on this program, which means the program would expire without reaffirmation by the Legislative Assembly. The sunset has been established in 2008, meaning the jurisdictions, and you might notice there are only seven cities that are allowed to do this. This was a pilot program, but there was no sunset applied to it. So these seven jurisdictions are the only ones that are allowed to do that. But it would require then that these jurisdictions come together to the Legislative Assembly in 2007 to re-up the program with an affirmative vote. And I'll be very candid about this. Why are these other jurisdictions are included when they're doing everything perfectly fine? It's because if we can't get a jurisdiction to do that, I certainly know the value of peer pressure, that they don't want to lose their authority because one jurisdiction believes they can exceed the law. And so this is how this has come. It's been a very frustrating experience, and I think we're going to hear how good the program is. But I will emphasize, Madam Chair, that's not the point. We'll agree it's good. The question is, should you be allowed to exceed the law? And why is it all the other jurisdictions who are here today and will tell us how well their program is working are able to do this within the confines of the Oregon Revised Statutes? And with that, Madam Chairwoman, I'll present that Senate Bill 153.
All right. Thank you very much. I don't see other jurisdictions who have signed up to testify as witnesses. I see people from the city of Beaverton. I'm very glad to have them there. I don't know if I don't have all the sign-up sheets. Perhaps that's the...
And I see in our packet, Madam Chairman, we have some other jurisdictions who have submitted...
We have some who have submitted written material, so... All right. What I'd like to do is start off and ask. Before I do that, let me just say that I voted for this program, and that I've been very supportive of this program. I also am a former mayor, and so it gives me a little local government background experience as I listen to the testimony today. So I thought I would just kind of lay that out for a little bit of the environment here. I think that we're here to... I wanted to hear Senate Bill 153. Actually, Senator Metzger did not request that I hear it. I didn't even know it was his bill. I thought it was substantive, and I thought at the time that I saw the bill, the thing that caught my eye was the sunset date. And I thought that for the investment that is made by a city, being a former mayor, I looked at it and I thought, whoa, let's talk about this one. And so I asked Judith if she would schedule the hearing for today. So that's kind of what brought us all together here, and the buck stops here. I was the one that wanted to hear the bill, and actually did not know a lot about the background of it, other than, as I said, the sunset date caught my eye. I'm going to ask that Mark Landauer from Portland come forward.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations.
People in the back of the room can hear you.
Very good. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I've asked Mark Lear with the Portland Department of Transportation and Sergeant Beryl Walker with the Portland Police Bureau's Traffic Division to come and explain our position on this bill, and thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, my name is Mark Lear. I work with the Portland Office of Transportation, manage the Traffic Investigations Group, and it is a real honor for me to be here to talk a little bit about why in the City of Portland we think our investment in automated enforcement is really a smart thing to do and meeting the will of the residents of Portland. One of the hard parts about my job is my group that I manage is 7 engineers inside the City of Portland's Office of Transportation. It's sort of the frontline group that neighbors call when they have a concern about speeding. And we look for, you know, the 3E approach, education, engineering, and enforcement as a tool to try to solve these problems. And we can continually find a lot of value in using automated enforcement to try to address these issues. Over the years, Portland has invested in three photo radar vans. In addition, we have 6 red light cameras. Last year, we wrote about 21,000 photo radar tickets and about 9,000 red light camera tickets. That sounds like a lot of tickets, but when you think about the 6 cameras operating for a full year, it turns out only to be 4 violations a day. And what we find with those violations, these are people that are entering the red significantly after it's turning red, often with very high rates of speed. So we think that we're that's a very valuable investment for us. If you look at the big picture, we spend about $1 million a year out of our $137 million police budget on automated enforcement. So again, we think at less than 1%, it's a valuable investment. Prior to last session's increases in fine revenue, the City of Portland was subsidizing our automated enforcement at a cost of about $500,000 a year. Again, I think that's a real good sign, at least from our perspective, that not only is it a really valuable technology, but it's actually worth us putting our valuable general fund dollars against. Since the fine increases have gone into effect, we think revenue will actually cover the cost of the program, and we've set up an advisory committee that includes trauma nurses, school superintendents, and other members of our bicycle and pedestrian community to help us if there's any extra revenue which we'll dedicate to traffic safety services. The history for Portland and for Oregon in automated enforcement is that it really came from the citizens. In Portland, we had heard so much from residents, from neighbors, that they were concerned about traffic safety that they actually came to our Office of Transportation with a Reclaiming Our Streets proposal. They helped us, or we helped them, in going to all 95 neighborhood associations in the City of Portland and getting a letter signed from each of those associations that we then took to the legislature in the mid-90s to get the original authority for the photo radar program. The hard thing that we struggle with in the City of Portland is even though we have $137 million in our police bureau, the traffic division at any one time only has 4 to 6 officers focused on traffic safety. And so for us, having these automated enforcement just ends up being such a valuable resource for us. It lets us do intensive focuses in specific corridors. Another thing that we've done a lot of work on in the last few years is to work with traffic safety data that we've gotten from DMV to identify the corridors that have the highest crash rates. And we've identified what we call safe corridors, strategic and focused enforcement corridors, and we're continually trying to make sure that we get our photo radar resources out where we have those biggest problems. In addition to that, we use what we call a traffic safety and livability hotline, which 823-SAFE in the City of Portland, that we have people call if they have specific concerns where they'd like us to get photo radar out into the community. On the issue of public acceptance, we did survey work before we started photo radar when we were trying to convince the legislature that it would be a good idea to set up these pilot programs. And at that point, only 42% of the public knew what photo radar was. At that point, we had about 70% approval. A year later, for use of photo radar in neighborhoods, a year later, after we'd been doing photo radar, we did the same survey. And at that point, there was a 80, lost my numbers here, but there was a much higher level of understanding of the program. And at that point, I guess it went up from 42 to 88%. And at that point, the support for the program had gone up from 69 to 74%. So that was a real positive thing for us. We're really committed to working with ODOT, other jurisdictions, to try to make sure that there's strong support in our city as well as in the legislature. So we encourage these kinds of conversations. One last thing that I'd want to hit on in closing is that we think citizens are really right in the city of Portland to be making public agencies pay attention to this issue. Between 1990 and 2000, there were over 85,000 Portlanders injured in traffic crashes. 467 Portlanders were killed. Someone has to see all those fatality reports. Whatever we can do to solve these problems in a smart way, we think is a real high priority. Just to put that in perspective, those injuries are 10% or 38% more injuries than we get from any other kinds of crime, and the fatalities are 10% more than murders in the city of Portland. So it's a major public safety issue for us. So in closing, we really recognize the value of working with the legislature and other jurisdictions to solve these problems, but we would really, because of the success of these programs, we would encourage the legislature not to sunset authority. Thank you.
Does that complete your testimony?
That does. We've asked Sergeant Walker to be here just in case there are any questions of a technical or enforcement type that we can have.
Because of the number of people who have signed up to testify, I'm going to move on.
Very good.
We have someone with a time constraint.
Can I just ask one question, though?
Sure.
Mark or Sergeant, respond to these things, if you could, for me. And I think you run a great program, and my office is in Sandy Boulevard, and there are little signs right there in front of my office.
Great.
Have you ever run your the program outside of the city limits in violation of the statute?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Metzger, no. We have always operated the photo radar vans within the city limits.
And have you always operated within the number of cameras allowed by law, or less?
Yes, less than the number allowed by law.
And finally, on the certificate of innocence, if someone provides a certificate of innocence and their driver's license and clearly shows it is not him, are those tickets dismissed in the city of Portland?
Yes, they are.
So my question, Madam Chairwoman, is you've told me how you have such a great program and you've been able to operate that within the law. What would be your advice if another jurisdiction felt they had to go outside of the law to do that? Would you feel that would be a proper use of that authority to exceed the law when clearly the city of Portland is able to run a very successful program within the law?
Well, Senator, in my opinion, I think that based on their counsel's advice, if they believe they're following the law, then they're going to operate their program in that fashion. However, we've had several conversations with our city attorney and the Portland Department of Transportation, and I can only speak for the city of Portland in that we certainly would not go outside the law, and we'll follow the statute as it's written.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mike Staropoli. He has a time constraint. He's going to leave, and I'll call next.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mike Staropoli. I'm an attorney in private practice. I'm a former prosecutor. I practice out of the Portland metropolitan area. I'm also an almost 20-year resident, homeowner, and citizen of the city of Beaverton. I appreciate the committee taking this look at the legislation. I've forwarded a packet to you, and as might be my oak as a lawyer, the top of the packet is a Court of Appeals case, which I bring to your attention, not for your specific review right now, but because having seen the development of photo radar and the legislation as it goes on, this case actually takes away some of the check and balance of the judicial system. Its interpretation of the two statutes as it applies to photo radar, not photo red light, but photo radar, 810-438 and 810-439, limit the court's ability to enforce some of the requirements, the notice signs, for instance, in 438.
And therefore, I would urge you in your review and passage of this legislation that you consider the limitation of Kolish. And I will speak to how that limitation has affected especially the city of Beaverton, since that's where I have found myself with clients who receive photo radar citations. Unfortunately, because I only was invited to this hearing yesterday, I don't have copies of these photographs for you, but I will leave these with the committee. There are photographs, five different photographs, of photo radar sites in the city of Beaverton, four of them all in one location on Jameson Road, the other on Canyon Road. You will see that the notice signs that were posted by the city have been posted in a variety of ways. At least one example is clearly out by the street, easy to read. Other times they've been posted at angles. They've been posted behind mailboxes. They've been posted so that drivers going down the street heading toward one of these photo radar units would be unable to reasonably be expected to actually see these. And it's very disturbing to me. My kids laugh at me because when we drive around the city, if I have the camera, we'll go back around and I'll take pictures. The other day, my 13-year-old and I went back up on Canyon Road and took a video camera because the sign on the back of the photo radar van that is supposed to post the speed for the driver posts the speed after the driver has gone far enough past the van that the driver in the vehicle can't read the speed. And I don't know the value to requiring the posting of the speed if the person driving their vehicle can't even see what that speed is. So I submit to you that Kolish case and the originals of these or photocopies of these color photographs for your review. In addition to that, you're already aware that the city of Beaverton has, on a number of instances, had to go back and dismiss citations because they were outside of the city limits. I have actually, in addition to the largest of those motions, four other motions where the city of Beaverton had to go back and dismiss tickets because they enforced a 30-mile-an-hour speed limit in a 40-mile-an-hour zone. They enforced a school zone in a non-school zone. And they again went outside of Beaverton city limits on a subsequent occasion after the original incident they have. So the city of Beaverton has struggled immensely. In addition to that, in your packet, you will see internal city of Beaverton emails and memos in which a city of Beaverton engineer commences a discussion with other members of the city that the city is not in compliance with state law as is required with signs on major routes into the city. They haven't posted them as they're supposed to. And yet I can tell the committee that despite the fact that the city of Beaverton recognized in-house that they were out of compliance with state law, that they continued to issue and convict people with photo radar during the time they were not in compliance. Because I actually had a client who hired me, and we went, found these as a result of that case, and then had to try the case showing with testimony from the city of Beaverton that even at the point that they posted some of these signs, two of the three, they still had not posted the third. The last thing in the packet that I have for you is a general order from the Beaverton Police Department. If you go back to the photo radar statutes, you'll see that it's required that it be enforced by a police officer. It appears to me that the city of Beaverton, through its police department, has attempted to redefine that term under subsection 12, the city of Beaverton and its general orders, and I can't tell you whether these have been revised since they were originally written, provides for a special position for photo radar reserve officer enforcement. However, when doing so, the city makes it clear in that very clause that by virtue of taking this oath and by being hired in this position, the reserve officer shall not be considered a sworn member of this department. And I know that the union for the City of Beaverton police officers is currently in the process of discussing that issue with the City of Beaverton because of their concern for how they've expanded that definition. I'd also note that the City of Beaverton has on at least two occasions, if not more, issued tickets to its own officers when those officers were on duty responding to calls, and despite the fact that the City of Beaverton Police Department was aware of that, they issued the ticket first to the city, which is how it came in, then to the individual officer, and only after the union got involved and threatened to grieve the process, the city then dismissed the tickets against their officer. I'm hopeful that what's taking place in the City of Beaverton isn't taking place on a greater spectrum. My only exposure is to what's taking place there because of where the tickets have come from. But I would encourage you, particularly in light of that one case that I gave you, that the legislature does indeed need some opportunity to see what's going on and make sure that there are enforcement, the ability to enforce the law enforcers in following the law.
I thank you for your testimony, and I apologize. I believe I mispronounced your name.
That's all right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I see Senator Charlie Ringo in the back, and I'm going to ask him if he'll come forward now.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Charlie Ringo, Senator from Northwest Portland and Beaverton. I want to start with a story. It's a true story of last Saturday morning. I had a breakfast meeting in downtown Portland at 7:30, and I take the exit into Portland, turn north on 12th Street, and go about two blocks, and some lady comes to a red light and hits me. And, you know, a fair amount of damage to the car, but that's about it. But, you know, we get out and we talk, and she said, you know, God, I saw that light was red, but I was in a hurry. And I said, so you ran it on purpose? I mean, you ran this red, you saw it was red and you ran it anyway? She goes, well, yeah, I was in a hurry. And, you know, it illustrates to me how careless people are. But really, you know, I was lucky to only have vehicle damage. I mean, there are people that are severely injured and are killed by people who really don't care about the traffic laws. And in my community in Beaverton, where we have a lot of congestion, it's very common for people to run red lights. And this is a very, very important safety issue to my community. Now, there's a variety of tools at issue for our community, and photo red light is an essential tool. And that's why I urge you to vote against this bill. We need to have photo red light radar in Beaverton for safety. Now, I know that Senator Metzger is upset with a number of the details and how this has been implemented in Beaverton. I know that Beaverton has done some things, and we just heard some testimony that where we can all say, no, that wasn't right, that wasn't right. Some of those things, it's clear, were not proper. In other areas, it's a matter of ambiguity. How do you interpret the law? Well, the way you interpret that law is how a judge is going to interpret it. Frankly, it really isn't even the authors of the bill, you know, or even legislative counsel who's going to say this is the way you interpret it or that's the way you interpret it. The way you interpret the law is when it's challenged in court and some judge says, well, this is the language that's the law and this is how we're going to interpret it. The bottom line is, we need photo red light radar. We really do. It's a public safety issue. People are injured. People are killed because of careless drivers. And I think there's a better solution out there. If the problem is that Beaverton is somehow being uncooperative or inappropriate in the way they're enforcing this, then let's address that. I don't think this is an appropriate way to do that, and I urge the committee to vote no.
All right. Any questions, Senator?
In deference to my good colleague, I won't ask questions.
Thank you very much.
Did you have a question?
I did, but we'll let Senator off. This
All right.
Thank you.
I'm going to take the chairman's prerogative, which sometimes you can do that. And
you can always do that when you have the gavel.
That's right. That's right, and I've got it. I'm going to ask Dean Meissner, who is the Beaverton with the Beaverton Police, and I bring you up because I think rather than having lots and lots of testimony, let's just get substantive and get to the heart and let you have some questions. And I request that all committee members be very civil to the Beaverton Police. And I also request that you take my greetings back to my very good friend, your mayor, Rob Drake.
I will, ma'am. Thank you very much. And Madam Chairwoman and committee members, thanks for this time. I just had a few things to go over. I understand, I think, what the key issues are. I'm Lieutenant Dean Meisner. I'm a lieutenant with the Beaverton Police Department and have been involved with the photo enforcement program for quite a while. My chief asked me to let you know that he would have been here today, but they're all down at the Seaside for a PSETS executive conference. It's a DPSST thing. So, but he this is important to him and asked me to be here. The citizens of Beaverton depend upon us in the police department to make the streets and the intersections and the sidewalks safe for them. That's our job. That's what we do. ODOT tells us, and it's unequivocal, that the leading contributing cause of serious injury crashes in the state of Oregon is speeding. We take it seriously in Beaverton. Traffic enforcement is a dangerous job, unfortunately. I brought with me one of my motor officers, Officer Ryan Mills. We have four motor officers in Beaverton. Currently, one of them is intensive care at Emmanuel with a serious head injury. Another one is off on extended disability leave due to a serious back injury. It's dangerous business, but it has to be done. The photo enforcement technology allows us to cover a lot more bases than we could with just the bodies that we can put on the streets. It helps us to cover that mandate in a safe and efficient manner with the limited resources we have available. I don't know what else to tell you other than the citizens of Beaverton value their traffic safety. I'd like to read a little letter here real quickly, and then I'll answer some questions because I'm sure you've got some. And this is addressed actually to Officer Mills. He got this in the mail this week. I'll just read it. It says, Officer Mills, almost 3 years ago you stopped me on Milliken and TV Highway. It was June 25th, 2002. I was coming home from work. It was early summer, but already plenty warm. I was speeding to make the light. I was driving 54 miles per hour in a 35 mile per hour zone. You gave me a ticket, of course. In all my years of driving, this was the first citation ever. I was shocked, but the real shock came when I saw it would cost me $180. Of course, after a while, I was upset. As a relocated Californian, I was accustomed to speeding just about everywhere. My court date was in 2 weeks, and I had that time to think it over. My court date arrived on July 10th. I drove there cautiously and paid my fine. After I left, I drove to work cautiously as well. At first, it was the cost of the ticket that was responsible for my newly found responsible driving skills. As the time passed, though, they became a habit. In retrospect, it took that ticket to make me realize that I had forgotten that driving is a privilege. Almost 3 years later, I still think back on the impact of that event. If you hadn't stopped me, I may still be speeding, have been involved in an accident, or much worse. I'm sure that you were just doing your job that day, and I hope that you realize how much so many of us value the job that you do. As a friend of a former police officer, I know that it isn't often that people take the time to say thank you. Thank you for making a difference in my life. Sincerely, Anna M. Lucas. I wish I had 100 guys like him on motorcycles, but I don't. We've got some two-photo speed enforcement vans, and we've got intersections with photo red light. Doing photo red light enforcement, and I testified last time I was down here about that, is probably the most dangerous thing that a motor officer can do. Once you observe the violator, if you can park in a position to do so, then you got to cut against the flow of traffic and try to catch him and stop him and stand out in traffic and give him a ticket. I value face-to-face contact between the violator and the officer more than anything, because it's that immediate feedback to the behavior I think that's the most effective. But like I said, we don't have 100 of these guys. I've got two right now. From my perspective, a ticket in the mail is better than no ticket at all. And I think if you listen to the words of Ms. Lucas here, I think photo enforcement citations have that desired effect. I think you get one in the mail, and I think it makes you think about your driving next time. We cite at 10 over in the speeding, and our standards are the same as Portland's. The light has to be flat red before you hit the first stop line on the intersection before the camera's activated. So these are egregious violations. And with that, I just wanted to say I did
I didn't come completely prepared. I brought one of our photo enforcement operators checklists here. Talks about how our operators set up the van and implement their speeding enforcement. I didn't make enough copies, but I can certainly supply that, and you guys can have a look at this if you'd like. But on our checklist, I'll just go over it real quick. It gives a location, date, and time where they are putting the van out, and then the actual setup checklist covers a variety of things. The very first thing, confirm location of the van and a fence is within the city limits of Beaverton. And yes, I am aware that we had some early instances of being outside the city of Beaverton. Let me just say that the city limits of Beaverton are an ever-changing thing. As you know, there are some annexation issues coming up. And
you don't want to go there.
No, I don't want to open that can of worms. But you know, it's difficult for us to tell what's in and what's out of the city. On any given day, dispatch can tell us one location is in and one location is out. It's we depend upon our engineering division to keep us updated on that, and they do a very good job. But I know in the instance of all the citations that were written on Center Street, we were talking about a matter of feet. It wasn't like we were 2 miles outside in Coburg doing citations, or we weren't on I-5. We were a matter of feet outside, and the city did the right thing. They refunded those citations. We've had some difficulties, I think, in implementing this program from the beginning because it was new technology for us, and it was a new program that we built. We made some mistakes, but I think the city has had a very good record of rectifying those mistakes when they've been brought to our attention. That's really my input on this today. Like I said, I was involved with the photo enforcement program fairly intimately for a couple of years. I was the sergeant in charge of the traffic unit when we went photo red light online, and was part of the initial process of ramping that up. I've since moved into the community policing division. The lieutenant that's in charge of the traffic division couldn't be here today because she's got a family illness, but I came down.
When I asked for the hearing of the bill, I actually did not know of the conflict of perhaps the city of Beaverton interpreting the statute in a different way than others that have been using it. And so I'm having a little problem here getting my arms around that aspect of it, because it seems to me that we all are adult people that can talk about things. So I think that needs to be addressed. Are you going to add your comments as well?
I really don't have much to say unless you have questions for me, other than, you know, instances of where I've almost gotten killed going through an intersection.
Are there some questions?
Yeah.
Senator Presents.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think everyone up here agrees with the philosophy that we want to have public safety and make sure we have individuals that are secure and people in our communities, wherever they may be, aren't running red lights. I think I personally, at the beginning, was opposed to photo radar because, as a prosecutor, I think having enough officers out there to actually have that direct contact was important. But I also realized in this day and time, it's not always able to do that, and this is a second alternative. With that understanding, Lieutenant, I guess what I want to know is, because of the, let's say, the state law is setting out guidelines as to how we wanted this to be implemented, having something that was more uniform throughout the state, wherever it was being allowed, without saying Beaverton's right or wrong, I've just barely been able to glance at the stuff, but if it turns out was shown that the city was not acting within the bounds of the state law that's been mandated for this program or projects, would you agree that Beaverton would need to come in compliance with what the state law provides?
Yes, sir. I mean, that obviously we have to work within the law. I mean, we are the law.
Right.
Yes, sir.
And based on some of the stories we've, at least the news accounts that have come from Senator Mexer's packet, it appears that some individuals have had to go to great lengths to attempt to prove their innocence. That seems to be beyond what is required in state law.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been discussion at the city level as to how to, let's say, reach a determination as to whether they, the way Beaverton is now currently implementing the law, whether it is in fact within the bounds of the state law?
Yes, sir, absolutely. And this might help a little. Beaverton's program, I don't know if it's the same as all the other programs, but our program originated in the mayor's office. And it's kind of a hybrid program. The police department operates the speed enforcement vans. We staff the photo red light monitoring. But beyond that, our involvement pretty much ends with the actual issuance of the citations. What goes on in municipal court is a municipal court issue. That's something that they take care of, and we have input, but those things, I don't know how to put this, are discussed at a higher level than I am. And we've had discussions about these things in the past. My understanding of this, and you know, I'm just I'm a lieutenant now, but I'm still at heart I'm a street cop, and I fully believe in accountability for one's actions. My understanding was that the reason Oregon is a driver ID state was that the legislators who were initially involved in drafting this legislation were very intent on the fact that the person who was responsible for the behavior was the one held accountable, and that there wasn't really any chance that a person who wasn't responsible for the behavior was going to be held accountable by some mistake. And so I understand that part of it. And as far as the certificate of innocence goes, and from the Beaverton Police Department's perspective, all we would do is deal with the reissuance of a citation when we got a form back that identified the person who was actually driving the vehicle. And this is very common. Rental vehicles, for example, or vehicles that are in commercial fleets, or, for example, Beaverton Police Department vehicles and Beaverton City vehicles. It's our policy that citations are issued no matter who's driving the car. If you want to talk about equality, this is probably the most, I guess, egalitarian program there is, because if a police officer is identified speeding in a police car, they're going to get a citation. And I heard reference to a couple of instances in the past where officers were identified in city vehicles driving, and you can bet we investigate those all the way down to the wire, and we make sure that those people are acting within the parameters of ORS and our department policy before we dismiss any citations, and I can attest to that. Our internal investigations unit doesn't look at that stuff kindly because we hold our people to a high standard.
Madam Chair, one other question.
Mm-hmm.
I guess based on what we're trying to deal with and making sure we have a uniform program throughout the state for those cities that actually have the authorization to do this, I'm wondering if you could provide to the committee whatever paperwork maybe you've received from up this chain as to how many locations you can actually operate within the city, what are the parameters as to posting those areas based on the testimony you've heard, and any other type of guidance that you've received. I understand in the position that you are, you receive a mandate, but some type of order that has told you to implement this program.
Absolutely.
And carry it out. But I also realize from what you've said that if you were in belief that something was in violation of the law, that you would question that. And I'm just wondering what you're getting as to how this is supposed to be implemented. Where is the miscommunication or misinformation that could be coming based on what the state law actually provides for?
I think I understand your question. As far as the actual implementation of the program, as far as the signing requirements, those kinds of things, those have always been an issue. From my perspective, it depends upon, I guess it depends upon what side of this issue you're on. And I know there were some things in the newspaper, and I tend to try to take everything I read in the newspaper with a grain of salt. I feel, as far as the signing goes, I feel fairly confident that we're well within compliance. The state law requires, and it says, a single sign to be posted within 100 yards of the vehicle. It doesn't say it has to be in front of the vehicle. It doesn't say it has to be behind the vehicle. It says within. So we post a sign on the approach to the vehicle, says you're entering a photo enforcement zone. We post a sign as you're leaving, you have just passed through a photo enforcement zone. And on our photo operator's deployment form, it's listed right down here, approach sign 468 feet, exit sign was 498 feet on this particular deployment. Our guys carry a rolling meter, they get out, and that's number three on their checklist. First, they got to confirm they're in the city. And then they have to verify that that nothing's in the radar's path, that kind of thing. And then they have to roll it out, put their signs out, and we have to lock the signs out because when we first started this program, the signs would disappear. Gosh, go figure. When they're out there on deployment, and someone would come and say, there was no sign out, and they took a picture. Well, no, there was no sign out because someone had stolen the sign. So we have to find places where we can actually physically secure the signs and lock them. I mean, it'd surprise you that people would steal these signs, but they'll do anything to get out of the ticket. And so they would take the signs, and then we'd have to go get another sign. So we began locking them up. So they have to find, there are some limits. They can't put them out in a bike lane because they're a hazard. Can't put them on a sidewalk because people with wheelchairs couldn't get by. So it's kind of tough. It sounds easy, but it's kind of tough to find a place to put the sign where people can see it and where you can lock it up.
If you could give us that documentation that you've received to implement the program, I think it would give us an opportunity because this is only a public hearing.
Okay.
Before we actually take action, I know for myself, it would make me more comfortable knowing exactly what directives you've received from your supervisors as to how to implement the program.
Okay.
You bet. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Very well. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
I'm going to call Ron Norris.
I think you're stuck. It's hard to get out of this chair. All this stuff.
Thank you for coming from Medford.
Well, Madam Chair and committee members, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify at this hearing. I'm the retired deputy chief, and the buck stopped with me. I made all the decisions when it comes to implementation of this program with the city of Medford with the support.
You need to give us your name and the city. I said it, but you need to say it.
Ron Norris. City of Medford. I'm a retired deputy chief. I'm here on a voluntary basis today. I'm representing three entities, the City of Medford, the OACP, Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, and also myself as a concerned citizen. I'm passionate about photo enforcement. It works, and it works well with us. 4 years ago, I testified before legislature to get Medford added, and then I bled through implementation with the assistance of Beaverton and Portland. I set up the program down in Medford. We went strictly by the legislation. We did the campaigns, we did the signage, we did everything. We had not one complaint when we were starting up. After about 4 or 5 months of implementation, the Medford Mail Tribune editorial came out supporting photo enforcement, both red light cameras and speed bands, and the last part, I believe, was thank you, Big Brother. And we've continued to have and solicit the support. I ran a survey after 1 year for speeding, and we had a reduction of 40 to 60% on our residential streets. It plummeted, and so did our red light running. I'm a businessman. I'm a deputy chief. I'm a police officer and a businessman. I don't do a program without a cost-benefit analysis. I know that to set up one officer 16 hours a day at a single intersection to watch red lights could cost as much as $200,000. I can do 8 intersections in Medford for it's actually cost neutral the way I've negotiated the contract with our current vendor. It works. I can tell you that it works, and I can tell you that we've done everything by the book. It's a fair process. It's not profiling. It's 6 months before I retired, I was on my vehicle going home off duty, and the van lit up. I saw it. The reader board lights up in the rear, and I'm thinking, well, they're tracking. I look in the rearview mirror, and nobody's there. 2 days later, they sent it through the internet to my office computer, and it was a violation with me and my vehicle. The municipal court judge happened to show up in my office just about that time. He looks at it and says, "Who's that?" He looked at it and says, "That's you." And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "You're guilty." I says, "Well, I haven't even got the cite yet." He says, "No, you're guilty." So I went upstairs, paid the citation, and also went to traffic school. I didn't see the sign. The sign was there, but it wasn't the fact that the sign really meant nothing. It's the fact that I was speeding. I was doing 37 to 25. I'm guilty. And another one, the very first person to set up, the very first day we deployed, was the patrol commander, Lieutenant Adamark Carr. He also went to traffic school and paid his fine. We do issue citations to the city people, to patrol units. If there, it goes to internal affairs. Internal affairs determines whether it's a violation. If, in fact, they were responding to a priority call, it's dismissed. Otherwise, they do get citations. It is a fair process. It works, and it works for the city of Medford. This sunset or eliminating or putting a drop-dead date on this legislation will hurt us something fierce. interest. Right now, I put $118,000 in two intersections for infrastructure for red light cameras. I've got to recoup that money somehow or another. And if I've got a sunset coming up, if I go to negotiate a contract with a vendor, they're either going to charge more or they're not going to bid. We're going to have problems finding people that are going to bid on this program. And I'm asking you, please don't sunset this. Hold us accountable is okay. To do a report every 2 years, have you look at a report with ODOT, which we've done, is all right. But don't sunset this on us, because that will hinder our program.
Very good. Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Norris, thanks for coming all the way up from your beautiful city to visit with us today. And first of all, congratulations for running a very good program. And as we were researching this in the interim after we received these complaints, we looked at all the other jurisdictions and can validate your comments that have run it very, very fairly and according to the law and very well received down in Medford.
Excuse me. If I can add, we have not had one case even appeal to circuit court. Everything has been handled in municipal court.
So would it be fair to say, Mr. Norris, based on the comments and the great editorial that came out in the Mail Tribune at that time, and the fact that you virtually have not only total compliance but support of this, is because you have followed the law and fairly, and people understand, whether they like getting the ticket or not, that they have been treated fairly and equitably and within the bounds of the law?
One of the most important parts of this was the educational campaign prior. And we were on television. They picked up on it. The media loved it. And print media. And then we have our own show. And, yes, we explained to the public exactly what's going to happen, how the programs work, both the photo enforcement and the red light cameras. And we have wide acceptance.
And would you say that that if you had a lot of complaints about being treated unfairly, that you would perhaps look the other way and say, what are we doing wrong in contrast to the results that your city has had?
We're always open to constructive criticism, and you're exactly right. If we do receive complaints, we look at those complaints, and if there's procedures that need to be changed, we'll change them.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you. Mr. Norris, thank you again for coming up. I know it's a great distance for anyone to travel. Do you believe that maybe we as a legislature sitting in our position should consider doing some type of uniform rules that would be in statute that would actually set forth how each city should actually implement the program and making certain that there is a unified model as compared to leaving for interpretation from jurisdiction to jurisdiction?
We did go through little confusion on the legislation, so we were with our city attorney. I spent a lot of time with our city attorney trying to determine what the legislation says, how we could implement. I would think that I would be more than glad to sit down with a legislative committee to define, if you want to make it more definitive, the legislation, to define exactly how this is to be conducted and to try to eliminate as much ambiguity as possible. Because it stands now, if the citizen is mad, or the attorney for the citizen is angry over the way it's run, it ends up in court, and the Court of Appeals will either tell you yay or nay whether you're abiding by the legislation. If you want a more definitive legislation as far as, don't sunset it, but if you want to sit down and define the rules better, I'd be glad, and I'm sure Portland Beaver would be glad to sit down with a committee and assist in tweaking the legislation.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Norris. I'm going to call Dick Cross. If you will state your name and the city in which you reside.
I'm Richard Cross, and I reside in the city or county of Washington, City of Beaverton. This is my first hearing, so I would appreciate any help in getting me through the protocol. Good evening, Madam Chair. And
you're doing just great.
That's the only part I know. I have, and maybe you can help me with process here a little bit. I'm here tonight because I'm concerned about Bill 153, 2008, being too late to solve the program. I would probably end it tomorrow if I could. And
My major concern is that the whole, and I'm primarily here for photo red light, because there is no correlation between safety and the photo red light program. And I wanted to present that. And I understand that may seem a little extreme, so I brought some data with me. And I'd also recommend you take a look at the pioneering work of, I don't know whether he's a senator or what he is in Texas, but a Senator Dick Armory is very concerned about photo red light. And you may want to check the San Diego case that recently went to the appellate court and discovered a lot of the information I've been working on my own. So what I have tonight, and maybe you can tell me whether this is the right way to do it, I believe there's a conflict of interest that's big and wide, that this is all about revenue. But rather than go into the black hole of safety versus revenue, I have some suggested additions, changes, or reform to 153. Maybe they don't belong in 153. They belong someplace else. But they're suggestions and that I think would clear up any conflict of interests. And whether this system goes away or not, there will be another system in the future, another wireless satellite system relaying traffic violations to, who knows, Bombay, India in the future. And so what I've tried to do is make this the criteria for a uniform system of automatic detection, and that's what I suggest would offer you. I also have as an exhibit to that submittal I have the honor of going, of being almost by divine intervention, I think, given back to back, almost 24 hours apart exactly, two photo red light citations. And unlike the gentleman before, I've already taken one of these cases to the circuit court on appeal, and I'm going through the discovery process. As part of that discovery process, I have an Exhibit 1 that I'd like to give this committee, and I think it's an important exhibit because what it shows is that we're pulling in about 36 people a day in this red light violation. Now, I don't know about you, but when someone says, are you against people running red light and do you want that heavily enforced? My vision is of a car sailing through an intersection while traffic is in progress, nearly missing pregnant mothers and innocent babies. And yes, I want that enforced. But guess who they're really pulling in? They're pulling in what I call the yellow-red violators who are off by a second. And in most cases, in all directions, traffic not only is not proceeding, but it's got red lights and they can't legally proceed. And that's the point that, one of the main points that Senator Armory in Texas is making. And that's what this data shows. 36 people a day. There's one intersection alone, in the shadow of the city of Beaverton, the nearest light, pulls in like 20 people a day. 28% are from Beaverton. The rest are from outside. So when people are asking, well, what do the Beaverton citizens think? It's a pass-through auto road tax is how I view it. When I was traveling in Europe, there were these feudal domains that used to sit in the middle of the river and they'd charge anybody that went through, and that's exactly what Beaverton is doing, in my opinion. So I've got some data here on how to fix that. If you really want to reduce the number of violations that you've heard about tonight, the horror stories of people and its danger and all that, you can drop, as they've discovered in other programs that have ended, you can kill all that. You can reduce that by 90% by just simply changing the yellow light timing from 4 seconds to 6 seconds. 90% of your violations will disappear. And so that's one of my proposals. If we're going to go automated, go 4 to 6. And there's other things. I don't know whether you want me to hand that out and go away or whether you want to ask questions regarding it. And like the previous people who came forward, I too only heard of this last night, so there's all kinds of errors in this, and it's a rough draft. But if you have any questions, oh, by the way, the photo light that they show you to convince people that they should, that they're guilty in that red light there, there's no evidence that the light ever turned yellow. None. And in fact, in some jurisdictions, they've tweaked down the yellow light timing so that can boost revenue. Now, I'm, call me naive, I understand as a mayor, Madam Chair, this being about revenue may have become sort of like a common thing, and everybody knows that. But I'm horrified when you're handed by a police officer a ticket saying you're basically a minor criminal, and that there's a conflict of interest with revenue. And the real concern I have is it's addictive. What's going to happen is people are going to become unemployed, they can't pay, and we can scale things down, but they're still going to have to pay that $330. And as that revenue disappears to that municipality, their first knee-gut reaction is going to be to increase the fine to pay for not only the equipment, but the Redflex contracts they're now obligated to pay in Arizona. So what you have is a system that every day wakes up and hopes to God that their citizenry fails at being good drivers. And I'm here to hope that we all can get good drivers. So anyway, I guess I've said my piece and would like to make this submittal.
Well, you did very well for your first time. And I appreciate your coming. Appreciate your testimony.
Senator Starr.
We all have different positions when we look at anything. No, I'll get questions.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, we all have different positions. When I look at the program, I saw public safety and not revenue, and you saw revenue, but that's fine. That's what it's all about. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the testimony. Thanks for taking time to come down and spend an afternoon in the Capitol. We modified last session, the legislature modified the photo red light statute because of a prior situation we had, quite frankly, with the city of Beaverton. But one of the things that we added to the law was a requirement that the cities have their timing on the yellow light be timed to an independent, I think it's independent traffic engineers or Institute of Traffic Engineers sets a standard about how long a yellow light must be. And what, that was one of the issues that I had been bothered by, the temptation that a local jurisdiction could game the yellow light in order to entrap the person that's running through the signal. So I wanted to have kind of an independent standard on that yellow light. You know, I originally, I think when I had my first draft, I put a specific second, you know, 4 seconds, 3 seconds, or something in there, and that was judged by kind of the traffic engineers as not appropriate, just because different intersections have different slopes and angles and all of those kinds of things.
Right.
The question that I would have for you is, do you have evidence somehow that shows that this particular jurisdiction, the one that that has issued you a ticket, somehow is not abiding by what the statute says as it relates to having their yellow light set by this Institute of Traffic Engineers standard?
Well, the short answer is I don't know, but I also have a comment with the problem in your approach a little bit. And this is a generic problem we have with high tech. As we improve our ability to find every traffic violation a driver has, we have to think about how we're going to get. Suddenly, mom and dad are creating more violations than we ever imagined because of human nature. They just make mistakes. But now those are all recorded and go on your driving record. And likewise, the problem is that whatever data they have on the 4 seconds in the criteria, which is, by the way, the right place to be looking, is based on the old-fashioned having an officer at the intersection, roughly guessing, looking at the accidents based on that. Take that versus a sensor in the back of the car that satellite relays down to Bombay, India, since they seem to be outsourcing a lot, that information. So what I'm saying here is, if you're going to go automated and get down to the to incredible detail on how people are going through in sections, you need to come up with new standards. What my criteria is, when I look and see that we're pulling in 25 people a day at one intersection in Beaverton, my first reaction isn't, my gosh, I'm glad they're getting rid of all those dangerous people. My first reaction is, the city needs to redesign that intersection, and we need to get it down to something like one or two today that are clearly dangerous drivers. And how we get to that magic yellow light number may take a little work, but we need to get there. I suggest any one of you go to municipal court like I did Thursday night and look at all the people being rounded up for photo radar and photo red light, and you'll be hard-pressed to tell the difference between a PTA meeting and the kids' high school play. That's who you're pulling in. They said, we're out, we're going to use these big nets to pull in sharks, and if you stand on that deck, you'll see nothing but dolphins and porpoises. So, yes, six seconds is in the right direction, or some length of time, or looking at that standard is what's about. Right now, I throw out the whole system because it does not show that that car ever had a yellow light. And you do not even have, I sat in front behind a testimony of a policeman who did, woman ran the yellow light. He had a videotape of her going through it, so they could show that in court at least. You don't even have that. You have no idea that there was ever a yellow light. They show you the red light transition, but that's it.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call Linda Adler. And after Linda, we have three city councilors from Beaverton, and I'll ask you to kind of be on deck and ready. All right.
Good afternoon. I'm Linda Adler. I'm Chief of Staff at the City of Beaverton. I'm here today. I was going to give you some statistics from the city, what a good program this is, but it sounds to me like the senators actually want to talk about problems that we've had, and I'm happy to do that. Let me try to respond to what I've heard so far, I guess. Certainly, there's lots of controversy about photo radar, speed enforcement, and red light. It is a tool that has saved us millions of dollars. If we were to do the same work with police officers over the 9 years, it would have cost us around $10 million. We've spent about $3 million on this program. We have a huge investment in infrastructure. These programs are revenue neutral. The city actually has not broken even on these programs yet. We will this year. The people who really make the money on these programs is, of course, the vendor, who gets paid for the work they do. The state of Oregon, who has had about $1.5 million from the city of Beaverton from the unitary tax, and the county, who has had about $500,000 so far in revenue. And that is to support the other court systems, and that's the way all tickets are divided up. And we understand that. So let me go through some of the issues that you've brought up. Yes, we were outside our city limits in 1997. It happened to be the case that we took a street from the county, were responsible for that street, have repaved it, and the normal course of action when that happens is that the entire street is deeded to the city who takes the street. For one reason or another, back when it happened in the 80s, the right-of-way agent at the city did not record with the county the deed which took the other half of the street. So to our knowledge, virtually every employee that we have been here since we had that street, all believed it was in the city of Beaverton, and we were on the wrong side of the street. The other side of the street is the city of Beaverton. Since then, it has been recorded. It certainly is ours. It had been deeded to us by the county. We, finding that out, did return all of those tickets because that was the right thing to do. We were going by the letter of the law. If you are not in the city, we can't operate that van. So we could have had people fight those. That's not the way my mayor does business. So he returned all of those. It was about $40,000, as I recall, worth of citations. Signage. Yes, we had an officer who, in court, said that he had not placed the signs appropriately. We dismissed all the tickets that he had written that day. We heard about it. We did it in reaction to what had happened. That officer is no longer employed by the city of Beaverton. We take this very seriously. The internal memo that you heard about on signage dealt with putting signs on 217 and US 26. That is not something that the city does, and our traffic engineer, although it was a nice idea, the fact is that's ODOT's responsibility, and those have been placed by ODOT. Reserve officers do not operate our vans. Never have, never will. We have sworn officers. They are retired police officers who operate our system. Mr. Cross's contention that we have 25 violations at one intersection. We only have 250 violations in a month total on red light. That's about two a day at an intersection. So he's looking at some statistics probably that lump in photo speed enforcement perhaps with an overall report, but it certainly isn't the red light. As to the yellow light and the timing, the city of Beaverton was in compliance last session. We have always set our yellow lights by the standard that Senator Starr has put in the bill and continue to do that. You also should know that no one gets a ticket on the red light until the light has turned red. The power doesn't even go to the camera until it's fully red. So it doesn't have much to do with whether or not you have misjudged the yellow light. It has to do with whether or not you are speeding generally and cannot stop in time. So once the light is red, then the camera activates, then people who go into the intersection are ticketed. Let's see. As to a unified model, my initial thought was, well, the city of Beaverton was the first city to have this program. Portland and the city of Beaverton were authorized. We put ours in place prior to the city of Portland. We had no direction on developing the form. The legislation does not give us that. We developed the forms with city attorneys' helps and looking at city of Portland also. But we put ours in place. And so perhaps what really should have happened is that the other cities who have since come in should have used our forms and our processes. Our city attorney has given you a letter which states, and I'll just read it because I think it gives the city clear authority to mandate a process for how it reviews the citations it issues. When jurisdiction is, by the Constitution or by statute, conferred on a court or judicial officer, all the means to carry it into effect are also given. And in the exercise of the jurisdiction, if the course of proceeding is not specifically pointed out by the procedural statutes, any suitable process or mode of proceeding may be adopted which may appear most conformable to the spirit of the procedural statutes. That's ORS 1.160. That is what we have followed in developing our program, in developing our procedures, and developing the forms which we use. No one in the city of Beaverton is forced to fill out a certificate of innocence. When a citation is issued, it is a summons to the court. And one must respond, and there are several ways in which you may respond to the court. You may write to the judge. If you don't want to be bothered with that, you may fill out a certificate of innocence and have it dismissed by the judge, This isn't by a clerk making these judgments. This is a judge. Or you may choose to come to the judge and argue your case in front of him. Those are the three ways that you can get rid of a citation. Same way you can get rid of virtually any other citation except for the certificate of innocence is not available on other citations. So with that, I think probably I should just answer questions specifically and see how I do on that.
Questions? Senator Metzger is recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Adler. I must tell you, over the years, I'm just perplexed sometimes about the ability to construct the law from your city attorneys very creatively, and I have difficulty with some of this, and I want to talk a little bit about the law before we talk about where our next steps might be. In the letter that you have submitted from your city attorneys, it's very creative language here in the second paragraph, and I'm going to quote this if I can, Madam Chairwoman, for the audience out there. It says, in Beaverton, if a traffic ticket is a photo radar or a photo red light ticket that is issued to a registered owner who was not the driver at the time of the violation, the owner is given an opportunity to avoid a trip to court if he or she discloses the true driver's identity. No one is required to disclose information about the true driver's identity. They're simply requested to do so. And as you know, and we have here, it's submitted by your office when we had our first exchange on this particular issue last spring, a copy of your certificate of innocence, and it does require to be dismissed under the law that they require, it is required that they do fill out the identity of the other person. Although I understand, since this bill was submitted for pre-session filing, there's been some modification by Beaverton since that time. But I want to read then the cite the law as it is written in ORS 810.436. And I'm reading from Section 6A. If a registered owner of a vehicle responds to a citation issued under subsection 1 of this section by submitting within 30 days from the mailing of the citation, it doesn't say asking for a court date, it says submitting within 30 days from the mailing of the citation a certificate of innocence swearing or affirming that the owner was not the driver of the vehicle and a photocopy of the owner's driver's license, the citation shall be dismissed, period. It doesn't say you request a court date and I will do this. If you submit that, it will be dismissed. And it goes on to say that the citation from the jurisdiction may be reissued if the jurisdiction verifies that the registered owner appears to have been the driver at the time of the violation. And my question is clearly there are people who are the people in those pictures. And you have the ability to send them again to them, and at that time they would have to make a decision in court if it's clearly that driver. But the law clearly and specifically says that they must be dismissed. It doesn't say you have to schedule a court date. And your comments about this is like any other ticket where you can submit testimony right to the judge, you are by fiat mixing two different statutes. The law governing photo red light citations and how they will be dispensed by the jurisdiction in the court is specific to red light and photo red light radar and is not interacted with other citations. And you have just blended them by fiat together as if they were the same citation. And this is why this is governed very specifically. And my question is, as you have heard from some of the other folks here, other jurisdictions who have that same success rate and do exceptionally well with their programs are able to do that within the law. And why is it the city of Beaverton decides they always have to interpret law differently?
Madam Chairman.
Good.
Well, first of all, I've been part of this program for 9 years, and I was here in the original testimony. I was here when the legislature put it together, and I've testified on these bills at least a dozen times. Each of those times, I have had questions about certificates of innocence. The question is, from the legislators, you are reciting, aren't you? We do not want people not having their behavior changed. This is a program about safety. That's what we are directing you to do. It does not state it clearly in the statute, but we have been given that directive, and I have followed it. And I have followed it because the legislators have told me to. So although you may interpret it differently and read it differently, and each of it, our attorneys could read it differently too, and I'm sure every legislator could interpret it differently, we are doing exactly what the legislator has directed us. Now, if you want to direct us differently, we can do that. Without the certificate of innocence portion, because, of course, registered owners are not always the driver, these programs will not work. These programs will not have enough citations that any vendor is going to allow us to continue to do it. I can tell you that. So that's not the issue. The issue is, how do we keep people from killing other people by running red lights? How do we have an opportunity not to convict a person who was not driving? And how do we find out who that was and take care of the issue? We still have the incident in our city when someone runs red light. That doesn't go away just because there's a citation. That chance to hurt people, to have them killed, to have very serious injuries is still there. And we have to do something to stop it.
Again, I don't disagree with your assessment of the importance and the value that the program brings to the jurisdiction or any other jurisdiction. I think we've made that very clear. But you've made two very interesting comments right here. The first one was, you indicated that without the ability to look at who the driver was, these programs won't work. And yet we have heard from the other jurisdictions that they're working very well, and they will do it within the statute. You've also commented that people can interpret things differently, but Beaverton is the only jurisdiction that interprets this differently. And the third thing, and I'd like to ask a follow-up on this, you said that unless we do it our way, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing with that word, that there is not a vendor, which I think alludes to the comment from the gentleman that was just here, who will participate in a program unless you can have sufficiently increased citations as opposed to the issue of safety. And I thought that was rather interesting. So it's like you've established these quotas of the numbers we have to do, and is that a reason why the city of Beaverton has exceeded its authority because you can't meet the quota under the statute as it is currently written?
Madam Chairman, if I may. My comment refers to a contractual obligation. In business and contracts, generally, there's a price differential. And it's either on numbers or it's an overall amount. Either of those that go up, since we're already losing money, will not allow us to ever break even on these programs. All we want to do is break even. We aren't amassing revenue on these programs. We're trying to save lives. But there is a point where good city councilors and mayors are going to say, this is too expensive, this kind of technology. So if you have more citations, and we don't have an awful lot, we've written 60,000 citations in 9 years. That's not an awful lot, but it is interesting that these are all people who are deliberately violating the law. They're either speeding excessively or they're running red lights. So we need tools to help us with that. This is a good tool. No, we don't have quotas. No, we don't care. We'd be happy for it to put us out of business if that's what it takes. If everybody would abide by the law, we'd be delighted, sir.
One final question, Madam Chair. Cost is important for any city, and the chairwoman certainly understands that, being a mayor of a city herself in her career. And we're certainly concerned about the cost of administering any type of program. But there's certainly a cost when you have one of your sworn officers who has to spend time to come to court on issues, photo red light citations. There's a cost to the city and its citizens. And if that cost can be borne differently and is unnecessary, it seems like you have some offsetting cost. And I give an example, and members, this will be in your packet of other materials that, from Multnomah County Circuit Court judge who wrote to the committee attesting to the violation of Beaverton on their own volition. And also a packet of material I just received from Mr. David DiLorenzo, and yes, he is the brother of an attorney that we are aware of, who was cited, Ms. Adler, just two and a half weeks ago in Beaverton when he was in San Diego. And he amended your certificate of innocence, and again, this will be in your packet, sent his travel itinerary, his airline ticket, his picture of his driver's license, clearly was not him in the picture, and was required, again, they did not dismiss the ticket as per the statute, required him to come to court, required your officer to come, and for whatever reason, as the judge looked over the issue, and your officer said, yes, that's not him, and they dismissed the ticket. And yet, when you talk about the city spent that time to have that officer go there, when the statute clearly would have allowed that to be disposed of under the situation prior to that. And so when you talk about saving costs, isn't it a little disingenuous to say the city of Beaverton, by exceeding their authority and having all these problems and people coming to court to try and test their own legal rights, that you are imposing cost upon yourself? It is unnecessary.
Madam Chairman, if I may. Our certificate of innocence process is one which our judges review, the certificates of innocence. Our judges make the determination as to whether or not they, in good conscience, will dismiss that. Now, they have interpreted for themselves how they operate and how they want to do whatever they do with the certificate of innocence. They firmly believe, and I think our judge gave you a letter, that this is something that needs to be interpreted by the law, by a court, not by me, not by my mayor, not by you, sir. But the fact is, our judges look at those. They determine whether or not they want the person to come in or not, and it's up to their judgment. And we don't interfere in the judicial process. We have very clear lines in Beaverton between the legislative process of our policymakers, the administrative process, and the judicial. And we are never going to tell our judges how to operate this program. We won't do that. So the fact is, it needs to go to another judge or another court and be interpreted, or guidelines for whatever you want need to be put in place. And then cities can determine whether or not this tool can be used effectively. And I think that it would destroy the program a good deal if we cannot do the certificate of innocence. For one thing, it is not the intent of our city council to not have behavior changed. This isn't about citing people and getting money. This is about keeping our community safe. And you have to be able to do that.
There's the star.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one question. It's related to the statement that you made in your opening, or maybe it was in response to Senator Metzger's question. But the statement was that you testified 12 times, dozen times over the years in front of the legislators, and that legislators have told you that you are reissuing these tickets. I'd be interested if you can find on the record a legislator who in a committee room basically said to you to reissue these tickets. And in that context, it was irregardless of what the statute says. If you can go back, and I'm not asking for the specifics right now, but if you can go back and find that legislative history, I'd be very interested in that, because the legislators are the ones that helped to write the statute, and I think it's pretty clear about what the statute says. And if on the record legislators were saying something other than what was in the statute, I'd love to have that legislative history.
Madam Chair, we will attempt to do that. It's a number of years of hearings. But I can tell you that they weren't saying irregardless of the way the statute is written. What they were saying, in my view, was that they understood what the statute said, and they believe it says something differently than Senator Metzger does. And I have not had anyone in a legislative hearing say, absolutely do not recite. It's not the intention to do that. We have been asked numerous times whether or not we go ahead and recite an individual, not a vehicle that's a business car, but individuals. Do we recite our employees? Who is getting off this, and how are they going through a loophole to get off? And that was the concern. has been many times. We would have to listen to every hearing that I've been to.
Right. Due to the time, I'm going to call as our last witnesses the three counselors from Beaverton, and I'll ask if you all will please come up at the same time. Kathy Stanton, Catherine Arnold, and Dennis Doyle. Welcome. Give your name and city in which you reside for the record, please.
Good evening, Chairman Verger and committee members still here. My name is Kathy Stanton. I sit on the Beaverton City Council. This is my 14th year. I've just started, or 13th. How long have you been on? That's my 12th year. Sorry. Beaverton City Council and the councilors have two responsibilities: setting policy and overseeing the budget. Under our Home Rule Charter, it is our responsibility to represent the citizens in our community, to listen, discuss, and then to act. In 1995, we created goals to help us clarify and focus our energies to do the best job we could with the limited resources that we had. We have 8 goals, 3 of which apply today. Our number one, and I don't believe our goals are weighted one any more than the other. Goal number one is to preserve and enhance our sense of community. Goal number four, to provide responsive, cost-effective services to the community. Number five, to assure a safe and healthy community. With those goals in mind, the council stays focused. And with that focus, it led us to pass a resolution to use photo radar to assist us as a community to meet our needs, our requests, and desires. The Chief of Staff, Linda Adler, today has given you data in written form. I'm here to tell you Beaverton citizens want photo radar, and Beaverton streets are safer because of it. The article that has been alluded to in Tuesday's paper regarding the atrocities committed in Beaverton under photo radar, referring to the being outside the city limit on Center Street, I want to say that yes, as was relayed to you, it was the wrong side of the street that we actually did have jurisdiction over, but it hadn't been recorded. Be that as it may, would point out that everyone cited was still guilty of speeding. But all charges were dropped and all fines returned because it wasn't legally on the books. But it's important to remember that anybody who got a ticket that day had been speeding, had been violating the law, had been putting others in jeopardy. I was talking to a neighbor this morning about another issue, and she heard that I was coming today, and she said, "Tell my story." Twice now I've gotten a ticket on the street near our home, and both times I was guilty because I wasn't paying attention. 2 months ago, she was involved in some telephone survey, and this issue came up, and she said, "Yes, I got tickets. Yes, I was speeding. Yes, I like photo radar. Yes, I want it to continue. Yes, it's changing my behavior." And that, I want the committee to understand, is the reason the council initiated photo radar to begin with. We wanted behavior changed. Photo radar for us, to this day, is still primarily in front of schools and in neighborhoods. This is not about generating dollars. We don't make money on this. It's not our intent to make money, although wouldn't it be nice if we could. This is about changing behavior so kids walking to school can cross the street safely, so that people driving through the city, when they come to an intersection, whether they can see the little monitor things on the side or not, will slow down and pay attention to what the light is doing. That is the most important thing to remember in this. Beaverton obviously has human beings living and working in it, because only human beings make mistakes. And We have become the poster child for those mistakes. That's just because the focus has been on us. I don't care about that. I care about maintaining the integrity of the red light program and photo radar on the streets, because it meets the needs of our citizens, it meets the needs of the community at large, and it's saving property damage and bodily injury claims, and that's good enough for me. Finally, the only substantive changes to the current statutes is the addition of 3 and 4 to 810-438. In Senate Bill 153. Since this is identical language to that which already exists in 810-434, 3B and 4, pertaining to red light, there should be no hardship for those jurisdictions currently using photo radar. Please remember, whether photo radar or photo red light, these are just one more tool. These are tools that we get to use to provide for a safe community. I believe additional reporting will meet the needs of those who wish to monitor the photo radar programs throughout the state without constraining local jurisdictions from providing those services. These are services our citizens have demanded over and over again and still consistently come out as the very highest numbers of what they want to see happen in our community. Add 810-438-3 and 4. But please, do not include Section 4, because Section 4 does a disservice to local governments throughout the state who look for every tool imaginable to maintain their communities in a safe and healthy way. This is about local control, local responsibility. Fiddle with the statute any way you want to if you feel that constraints are necessary because of human error. That's your prerogative. But don't do away with the program that has become a tool in many toolboxes to keep our streets safe. In 1989, I was here for three sessions to get the 25-mile-an-hour registered speed limit. And I worked very hard on that. And that was a hard sell, too, because we didn't have that in the state. You know, there was 25 mile an hour in an urban area. But we were able to get it after three sessions because we said, okay, in a county with over 200,000 population, a local jurisdiction can do that. It was constrained over time so that statewide everyone was comfortable with the fact that a jurisdiction might want to have a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit. It has worked out very well for us because as we have grown in the urban areas, we have needed that control. Please don't take away our right to regulate ourselves. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Catherine Arnold. I'm from the city of Beaverton. I just took my position on the council this month.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Sometimes I wonder if people offer me the condolences.
Yeah, I bet.
I bet you do. I actually want to share a perspective as a citizen. And when I first got involved with our city's Committee for Citizen Involvement, it was in 1995, real close to about the time this came on. At that time, our committee, along with the neighborhood associations, were trying to raise money for a second smart trailer. And do you understand what smart trailers are? Okay. We had a hard time. We couldn't raise the money. And part of it was we'd go to businesses and say, will you give us some money for this? We had one from a grant, and it wasn't enough for what neighborhoods wanted because they were having problems with speeding around schools and in their neighborhoods, and we didn't have the manpower to ticket people enough to make them afraid enough to not speed. So this was something we could do. We have the smart trailer. Well, now we're trying to raise money, and businesses are saying, well, they're not going to do any good. So a conscientious person might go, oh, geez, I'm speeding, but people who don't care. There's not enough teeth in this. It's not really worth putting the money into. Shortly after that, we were able to start the photo radar. And as you've heard, and you can look on the net, all the successes, it works, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I know we don't need to argue about that or talk about that. But that is what's at issue. This sunset clause has serious ramifications for the ability of municipalities to implement these programs. And so that is at issue. If there's an issue about what we're doing in Beaverton, let's solve it in Beaverton. Let's not hang out everybody. To me, this is just a little bit You know, it's kind of like throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thanks for the time. Dennis Doyle, City of Beaverton. I've been on the council about my 11th year. So I've watched this process unfold for both the photo radar and photo red light. And I know as a strong proponent of both, I've seen it work in other countries and work well. The safety, you'll have the data over and over again. You get the same figures and probably better how it really does work. I get around the community quite a bit, as you might imagine, and I've talked to folks who've been really upset when they got their tickets, and one of them, a year of griping, I said, but, I'll leave his name out, how are you doing it when you come up to red lights? And I said, well, I don't follow the truck so close that I can't see the light anymore. So it is working. It is changing. I've seen some interesting things happen with the signs over the years that they do disappear. They do get replaced and moved. I think we're the hearing today and the bill before us is an indication that obviously there's some angst and understandable on the senator's part. But I think the solution lies in mediation or getting the cities together or whatever, get legislative council involved. If in fact there still appears to be a problem, let's solve it that way. We don't need to get rid of a tool that really does work. I think when I hear people talk about, you know, extend the time for a yellow, I do believe state statute says you go through on a yellow, you're guilty of running the light. I could be wrong, but that was what I've had explained to me very clearly. So folks in a hurry will make mistakes, and it is working. And the number of tickets you'll see in the reports, and, you know, I think it's a great idea to ask for annual or summer, you know, biannual reports. We do. We ask staff to let us know that, yes, it's working, because we are spending some serious dollars, and you know better than we do that every dollar you have now is extremely vital. And I hope that we've aired an issue that obviously needed airing, and the city, I'm sure, speaking for my fellow councilors, if there's adjustments we need to make procedurally, we will do that. It's not a question of us wanting to do anything else except provide safety to our citizens. And in the 11 years, I've gotten some interesting phone calls on the council phone. Not one has called up and said, get rid of photo radar or get rid of photo red light. As a matter of fact, they've heard thank yous. And it's interesting. Folks have a negative reaction naturally. They say, well, a camera shouldn't give me a ticket. Well, you know, we can't have a police officer outside your house when somebody's breaking in either to watch the perpetrator. So, you know, we have to draw some lines in society. And the numbers, if you talk to the chief, to sit at an intersection and really do the red light safely for the officers, it probably involve 3 to 4 officers per shift, and you figure out the numbers per year. So this is a viable way to get people to behave a little bit better. And we all have stories about how close this Senator Ringo indicated. So I just hope that we can step back and solve the problem in another fashion. I think it's very solvable. And interesting, the downstate folks, you know, they got tremendous coverage in positive ways from the media. Well, I'll guarantee you that didn't happen when it first came into the Beaverton area. There was TV stations out there wailing away about what this is going to do. I watched a reporter come out at the intersection. We're talking about Griffith Park and TV High, or
BH.
Yeah, BH, Beaverton Hillsdale Highway. Do a story. He was robbed the camera, and God is my witness, they walked across into traffic, into the red light, ignored the don't walk signals, and so on and so forth. So it's been a real interesting thing as a little old city councilor from Beaverton to watch this unfold, and I hope that we can put what I think is a dynamic tool, keep it there, make it better, and solve problems that seem to be there for people. And I think we can do that. So I just urge the committee to perhaps table the bill or pursue it in other ways for corrections that you see need to be made. So thanks for staying with us the whole time, Senator. I appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to steal Senator Przanski's question, because I thought it was a very appropriate one to ask, and that is, from all the discussion that we've heard, we all tend to believe in public safety, and we certainly want the streets to be safer, and we're not in public life, you know, to just think about revenue. What I want to ask you is, if indeed Beaverton is shown that it is operating not in the spirit or the letter of the statute, then would you be willing then to insist that that occur as city council.
Yes. Go ahead.
If it came up to us, going back to what I said at the beginning, we set policy and oversee budget. We are not the city of Portland. We do not have a commission form of government where we oversee departments. So there are many times when we are not involved in these loops. We three are here today because we either actively participated in the original legislation or feel strongly about it from our own point of view or from our constituencies. But yes, if it came up to us, I have to say yes. I took exception to some of the questions that Senator Metzger asked others earlier. He said they felt they had to go outside the law, always have to interpret laws differently, exceeding authority, believes they can exceed the law. Wrong. That certainly, from the council position, that's wrong. When we take our office, we have to agree to uphold the Constitution of the United States, the state of Oregon, besides our own codes and ordinances. At no time has the council ever suggested, intimated, or asked anyone to do anything outside the law. But in answer specifically to your question, if it came to us as a policy decision, I could guarantee you, based on the fact that we all took the oath of office, that none of us would be agreeable to flaunting the law or doing anything outside the law. And again, our own city attorney did write the opinion that we had. I mean, we hired him for his expertise and have to go by what the attorney tells us because the three of us are not lawyers.
Yeah, I just want to echo that. Of course we would. And we would, I know I would certainly work as best I could within my constraints to make those changes happen if they were deemed necessary. And I think the mayor and the administration would certainly follow suit without any prodding from the city council. They are folks doing a good job, and they want to continue to do that. And the thing that I sit back, and I know when I'll be driving home today if the freeways open up, it was a mess out there if you're heading north, is that nowhere in the testimony I've heard here and over all the years at the court have I ever heard somebody say, "I wasn't speeding." And I quarrel about the red light, but you sit down and watch it happen. It happens. I mean, I paid my photo red air ticket, 41 and a 30. Anyhow, way back when. And so, you know, it's pretty hard technologically to say it doesn't work. And, you know, lawyers are here to defend people and get people off tickets. And, you know, one of my favorite cases in the city was a gentleman received a ticket, fought it. He was 1 minute after the end of the school time frame for the speed zone in school, and the county judge said, "Okay, we're going to let you go." Now, you look at that and say, "Yeah, every kid's always on time to school," but you know, we could argue those semantics there. But I'd want to assure you that there's no way in the world Beaverton would not change its procedures.
And I'm fairly new, but I mean, you almost have to laugh rather than be offended. The idea that we might change the yellow so that we can get more tickets when what we're trying to do is stop people from being hit. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. And, you know, and I'm sorry, I really don't know that much. But interesting enough, the biggest argument that I see that I think has some merit is the interpretation of the certificates, right. But oddly enough, I do remember conversations with neighbors back when we were looking at this in 95, and this one fellow was saying, he was reading it that way too, and he was saying, "We should not even pass this law because it's not fair. So my wife is driving and she doesn't get a ticket, or all the city employees, they don't get tickets," or, you know, the exact same. So it's that old thing where you get beat up if you do, if you get beat up if you don't. I tend to try to think the best here, and I wasn't around to hear it, but what I'll see, unless it's proven differently, is I'm going to assume that I've got a competent city attorney, and that the way he was interpreting the law, he was trying to do what he thought he best could, you know, as within the limits of how you may, from legalese, interpret things. From common sense, I mean, common sense-wise, I'm sorry, but, you know, if my son got a ticket, yay, he doesn't get that ticket because I'm the owner of the car. What good is that doing the city? Or even, I'm sorry, but having to post a sign that says, hey, you're coming into photo radar, it's like, okay, so I'll look for the signs. That's what I'm teaching the behavior. Look for the signs. If the sign's not there, zoom, go ahead. I was delighted when it first was published and people were actually afraid to drive through Beaverton as far as they thought, oh, I might get a ticket. So I'm thinking, yay, whew, until they figure out that they can look for these other things that, you know, they'll slow down for a while. So I'm sorry. I mean, I agree with you. Maybe we need to look at things, but from a common sense, let's look at the intent of what we're trying to do with this. And one more last thing, I'm sorry, but another thing I hear from constituents, and you probably hear too, is all the time that government wastes on things that aren't important. And, you know, and I mean, this is important, and following rules is important, but what are we intending to do here? That's the thing. And if we've overstepped our bounds, I mean, if I see it, I would bring it up as a counselor. We really all want to do what's best. And, you know, we'll do our best, but we're trying to serve a public. And that's what we're really, I think, that's all we've ever tried to do in Beaverton.
Well, I think you're going to be a great counselor, and I'm going to let Senator Metzger say, what are we going to do here?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I echo the chair. I think your enthusiasm is going to be a welcome addition to the council. That's very clear that you really care about your community and want to make it better. The only comments I would make at this time, and we'll be revisiting this issue later and talking about it as we move through session, and I do appreciate the chairwoman bringing this so quickly because, as she mentioned, I hadn't asked for it yet. It's a little ahead of my own thinking on this. But this gives us a good framework for future discussions. But just a couple of suggestions I might, you know, make, and especially, Kathy, with you being new on the council. As we close today, number one, clearly we would not be here today if Beaverton was just following what all those other jurisdictions are doing. So there's, as a counselor, I would ask that question. Why is it that all the other jurisdictions, that no one has any really problem with them? And as I indicated earlier, you want to interject?
No.
Just getting ready.
And clearly, if they were following the Certificate of Innocence the same as the other participating cities, we wouldn't be here today.
Okay.
Number two, you talk about how the public really does support the program, and we've already articulated that is true. And in all these other jurisdictions, we heard, and that is true, and they do an excellent job in supporting the program. But I think it's interesting to note, and I would, in your area, would go back and look at the Oregonian from 2 months ago, in which, in your Washington County edition that comes out on Thursday, in which the Oregonian decided to have a reader's poll of how you felt about Beaverton and their certificate of innocence going beyond that. And if you notice, and they do, that's not a scientific poll, they'll tell you, but they do try to have representative letters. And it was every letter but one from your constituents were unhappy in the Oregonian poll about exceeding the requirements of the certificate of innocence. So I would just simply say, as a council, I'm saying, okay, there's an issue here. I'm a governing board, just like we are a governing board, and I think there are ways this could be solved. And the reason the other cities, as I mentioned earlier, are there, it's not because of the intention to make them ask for reauthorization. But again, quite frankly, I knew they would come. I knew what they have at risk, and peer pressure can be important. And I will tell you frankly, is that we have confided in our own offices, they have some frustration. And so I think as a matter of good process, maybe we can work to see how this is done. And I will conclude, Madam Chairman, with your one comment about, you know, changing the law. And if you'll look at the letter that I sent to Mayor Drake, offered that if this was not properly written, to bring to the legislature those modifications that you felt were proper, and declined to add any changes to the law to my request. So that is why we are here today. And hopefully, as we move forward on this issue, we can resolve this properly. That's all I have. Thank you.
And I want to thank you. Those were very reasonable comments, and I will, being new, this is something I think that's worth spending some time in understanding, so I'll follow up. And with that, I have to run away because I've got some Girl Scouts who are going to be at my house at 7 o'clock. So
okay. If don't run too fast.
Yeah. And Senator Metzger, your first point was why I'm here. I'm here about photo radar. I'm not here because Beaverton, because I was here in 89 and 91 and 93 and 95 and 97 and 99, 2001, every session on a local issue and on a transportation issue, because those are very important to me. If I wasn't on the city council, I would still be here today. I'm a mom. Do I care if I get dissed by my kids or by the next door neighbor? No, because my responsibility is to my family and to my community. So I'm here because this issue is important, not because anybody, yourself or going in, whomever, is bashing Beaverton. I really want to make that clear.
Madam Chair, just we'll wrap it up so we can all leave. Good advice. We'll follow through on that, and I know the mayor will be happy to talk with that. And you know, I know John, who wrote the soapbox, and you know, he also mentioned in the middle of that that's happened twice to him. And I'm going to kid him next time. He says, "Who are you lending the car to?" but thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with no other business to come before this body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.